Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
When we talk about race in America, it is easy to see things in black and white. But, of course, there's wide diversity within white and black populations. Anthropologist J. Loran Muturi has looked at the cultural differences among black communities. He has a new book called Stigma and Culture, Last Place Anxiety in Black America. Randy joins me now in the studio to talk more about the book. He's also a professor of cultural anthropology at Duke University. Randy, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us about this, a little bit about the centerpiece of your work and what it is you were looking at.
Very good. The book is fundamentally about ethnic diversity in the African-descended population of the United States, which includes substantial numbers of African and Caribbean immigrants. They constituted in 2007 about 8% of the self-identified non-Hispanic black people. And you could add to that the large numbers of Caribbean Latinos who are also of partly African descent. I study these populations in conjunction with a set of domestic populations of African descent, such as the Gullah Geechees of the South Carolina Lowcountry, the Louisiana Creoles of color, and a number of Native American populations of partly African ancestry that at various points have been called little races or tri-racial isolates, but in recent years have been reclaiming some of their ancestors' Native identity. And so the overarching and theoretical point of the book is that ethnic identity making is a competitive and hierarchical process that often answers a presumption of racial inferiority to a racially unmarked dominant class, and often uses as an element of its rhetoric a claim of superiority to some constituent other.
So wait a minute. Now you're talking about African descendants, so perhaps tension between Caribbean populations and what we would call an African-American population.
Yes. One might call it a tension. I might describe it rather as an ambivalence. Caribbean Americans who arrive in the United States sometimes quickly and sometimes gradually become aware of anti-black racism and often enter into very deep and long-term alliances with African Americans against racial discrimination. On the other hand, faced with the degree of stigma that every black-skinned person faces in the United States, mm-hmm. there's often an effort to figure out, wait, I'm not like that image that's being projected here. I must somehow be different from the African Americans who are perhaps legitimately the object of this accusation of inferiority. And consequently, one hears an elaborate discourse of Caribbean culture being superior to African American culture.
And how is this manifest? And so part of my question is, what's the narrative? But what are the other ways in which one would try to manifest this and other to distinguish oneself from a minority population that's having a hard time?
Oh, very good. Well, it's discursive. One expresses these ideas to white people. One also uses it as a child-rearing technique.
So what do you say if you're Caribbean and somehow you feel like, they see me as a black man, I better straighten out this white guy. What do I say to him?
Oh, well, it varies. There is often a deer in the headlights phenomenon where people have to make a moral decision. should I let this white person know that he's racist and is justifying his racism by declaring his favoritism for their blacks as opposed to ours? Or should I take advantage of the presumption so that I can get a job more commensurate with my talents and my efforts? It's a dilemma faced by black immigrants in virtually every country in the world where, for example, mixed race and black immigrants and Caribbean immigrants in Europe often face the dilemma of whether they will tell a neo-Nazi, no, I'm not an Arab. No, I'm not an African. In order to save themselves from being beaten.
You have an example here in the book, too, of a professional Afro-Caribbean who at some point becomes disgusted with the fact that whites have somehow seen him as an exception and feel very free to disparage other African-Americans in his presence as though you are not one of them. And that leaves him in that very difficult position.
Yes, it's a dilemma. And it's a dilemma faced by middle-class African-Americans also. Many of us teach our children by example and through words, in effect, not to act like lower class African Americans, with the implication that there's something wrong with and something responsible on the part of lower class African Americans for their marginalization. We teach our children to speak in certain ways, to dress in certain ways, to move in certain ways that distinguish us from the people most vulnerable to oppression. But sometimes that pragmatic advice extends, I think, into a logical error. It was difficult in the 90s and 2000s not to turn on the television and hear either Bill Cosby or Maya Angelou or Don Lemon talking about the droopy drawers and incorrect diction of working class African Americans as though those linguistic and stylistic traits were responsible for lower class African American oppression.
Right. Well, and it also leads to the subtle message that or the not so subtle message that there's something wrong with who you are.
Exactly.
And then you have to internalize that and figure out how you're going to navigate.
Exactly. Sometimes the articulation of distinction from a clearly inferiorizable other gives a great deal of self-esteem. There's nobody more proud than the despot of a tiny principality. But these assertions do rest on a capitulation to the premise of the inferiority of some kind of typical African American.
Well, and this is a hierarchy that if we extend it beyond, you're talking about what happens within the African descendants in this country. But this is how the game is played with whites too, particularly working class whites.
Very
At least
good.
You ain't black, right?
Very good. It's the history of all European immigration to the United States. A disproportionate number of the European immigrants to the United States came from regions where they were racially stigmatized in Europe and where they were regarded as culturally inferior and not worthy of the rights of the dominant ethnic group in the country, which was unmarked as an ethnic group. They were marked as an ethnic group.
Right.
But once they arrived on the shores of the U.S., if they could demonstrate that they were not black and that they were adequately, sufficiently hostile toward African Americans, they could join whiteness and entertain the hope of entering the middle class. And it seems with the declining economic fortune of white Americans, those who have fallen the deepest feel that they have something to lose by some minority of African Americans gaining rights and assets similar to what they think they're entitled to.
You've had some personal experience with this as well, stigmatization in higher education, friends with a Jamaican woman when you attended Harvard.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
And it wasn't exactly discrimination. I don't mean to stigmatize her, but yes, I dated the daughter of a Jamaican surgeon and a Jamaican nurse. My father was an African-American surgeon and my mother an African-American psychologist. And my friend always knew, she introduced me to Prince. She always knew the latest and hottest African-American music before I did because she grew up in New York. I grew up in relatively provincial Washington, D.C. And in our friendship, I always just assumed we were local variants on African-Americanness, the same kind of culturally polyglot African-Americanness that I had grown up with. We ate not only Chinese food, but Lebanese food, Caribbean food, African food, fried chicken, and so forth. So I didn't perceive any difference between us as being cultural. The most prominent difference I perceived was that her parents had never married and mine were divorced. But decades later, when I began hearing much of the scholarly discourse about the difference between Caribbean professional performance and African-American professional performance in New York City and the sorts of discourse of superiority that that accompany it, I asked her if she'd ever felt culturally different from me. And I asked the question skeptically, but she responded, hell yeah. She had always thought of herself as different from me. Which illustrates the point that cultural difference or ethnic difference is not fundamentally about wholesale cultural differences. It's about strategic and emblematic assertions of difference in the pursuit of honor and earnings.
In some ways, though, they have to be plausible if you're going to convince a dominant culture that's not familiar at all and doesn't even bother to recognize a difference.
Yes.
You've got to come up with a plausible difference. So what is it? And I think in Jamaican culture, it has to do especially with education and speech patterns. Is that part of it?
Yes, that's part of it. There are distinctive speech patterns, but there's often a strategic element to the representation of those speech patterns and other emblems of ethnic identity. So, for example, I regularly heard in these circles that Caribbean culture was superior to African-American culture, and Caribbean culture was identified with valuing of education and especially exam-oriented education, speaking the Queen's English, monogamous families and parenting within the nuclear family, and speaking with certain patterns of diction, which I'll tell you a joke about in a minute. And yet, when I spent a comparable amount of time in Jamaica, I realized that what was being described as Caribbean culture generally was there recognized as a distinctive minority middle-class culture. It was called a middle-class culture. So basically, a minority class culture whose self-understanding is in deliberate opposition to the majority of the population of Jamaica has been reinterpreted and renominated,
yeah, okay.
Renominated a regional culture. Black immigration to the United States is disproportionately professional, high income, and high educated, especially the African immigrant population. The African immigrant population is among the most educated and wealthiest continent of origin immigrant groups in the United States. Part of the logic of immigration is its selectiveness.
Right.
I
would expect much more discrimination, a much greater effort to put distance between me and the African American population of several generations.
Exactly, and note that what's represented as the African American population is artificially homogenized in this discursive model, as though all African Americans were poor, as though all African Americans were criminal, as though all African Americans gave birth to children out of wedlock, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and in fact, the rates of out-of-wedlock childbearing in the Caribbean are significantly higher than among African Americans if you look at the culture as a whole. So I wanted to tell you a linguistic story, a little joke. So this is a middle-class joke told about working-class Jamaicans in which a teacher is presented. Oh, there's a boy named Eric. And Eric runs up to the teacher and says, Tisha, Tisha, Ari itmind Edward Ama. And the teacher replies, Herrick, you idiot. You have to pronounce your H's.
Who would tell this joke?
A middle-class Jamaican demonstrating his or her cultural superiority to the average Jamaican. And yet, in the United States, the suggestion that the Queen's English is the standard form of language in Jamaica and the reference to its having been colonized by England, which is understood to be a sign of superiority relative to white Americans, because white Americans tend to feel inferior to England too, is a strategy. It's a strategy not only of impressing white Americans with their worthiness of inclusion, but also of disciplining their children, saying you have to act a certain way if you want to get ahead.
If you want to get ahead, especially in this culture. I've got about 30 seconds left, but I want to get your sense of how powerful this is, because obviously so many people, including white working class and underclass Americans, are so disadvantaged by this system that gives them no voice and no power.
Yes.
What they have in common with blacks of African American and every descent is obvious, except to some of them. How powerful is this cultural? Are these cultural markers, and is there a point at which you recognize, wait a minute, it's not about that. It's about what these corporations are doing to me.
Very good. Very good. Well, it seems to me obvious, most obvious in the Southern strategy of the Republican Party, that elite and wealthy whites are able to distract the working class white public with the idea that race and wedge issues like abortion and posting the posting biblical texts,
not to mention gender,
and right, they can be distracted and be made to vote along with the agendas of wealthy Republicans who are undermining union rights. I might take a second to emphasize that I regard this pattern of what I call ethnological Schadenfreude, that is, constructing one's ethnic identity in opposition to a supposedly inferior other, is a global pattern. It happens in relation to Jews in Europe, among Jews in Europe. It happens in relation to Eastern European Jews, in Scandinavia, in relation to Samis and Finns, in India, in relation to untouchables. So this is just the locus classicus that demonstrates a larger pattern of ethnic genocide.
J. Loran Maturi's new book is called Stigma and Culture, Last Place Anxiety in Black America.
The guy we're going to meet next always had an entrepreneurial streak. As a young kid, K.Y. King Garrett started a car wash business, and in high school he launched a clothing line. And he credits some important role models in business, especially his grandfather.
He was actually the first black electrical engineer in the Northwest, so that's his kind of, I guess, his tech background. And you know, later in his life, he was one of the co-founders of Liberty Bank, which was the first black bank west of the Mississippi, and it was created to give African-American and other communities who did not have access to capital, whether for businesses or for, you know, home loans or home improvement, access to the capital.
Liberty Bank was located on 24th and Union in Seattle's Central District. And today, just a block away, sits Garrett's latest venture, Black Dot. Black Dot is a startup hub geared toward connecting black entrepreneurs with support and resources. They link people up with mentors, networking opportunities, and a space to work. Garrett is one of four founders of Black Dot. He sat down with sound effect producer Ali Ferguson to talk about why it's so important to make sure people of color are not left out of Seattle's tech boom.
Small business and entrepreneurship are the lifeblood of a community. And we have African-American community here in Seattle and many other communities which are being displaced, been vulnerable based on years of systematic kind of underdevelopment. And now that there are other economies that are growing, such as the tech economy here and in other places, because the community has not participated in the growth, it's being displaced by the growth. And so it was important to have a space that was dedicated to strengthening small business and providing resources, skills, knowledge, and network opportunities for established and aspiring entrepreneurs to launch and grow their ventures. Black Dot is really about building a startup ecosystem, you know, in the black community, which has been disconnected or not been a part of the larger startup ecosystem. So I think Black Dot is critical as being an epicenter or a nexus, a center of gravity where many different minds and people can bring their gifts and they mix and new things are created and, you know, birthed into the community.
How did Black Dot emerge? I mean, what's its origin story?
So Black Dot grew out of the work of Hack the CD. The hackathon is over, you know, weekend, 54-hour period. You build out a venture, a business model, prototype, you know, and it's like a pitch contest or whatever. And so there were many projects that came out of that where the entrepreneurs or the innovators wanted to continue to go forward, and they needed both community and additional, you know, support and resources as well as a central space. And so that is kind of what gave birth to the Black Dot co-working space.
And what sort of entrepreneurs have you seen prosper here at Black Dot?
Well, we're in our first 6 months, so a couple of examples that come to mind are the Seattle Filmmakers of African Diaspora group, which formed here at Black Dot, and there's been a variety of collaborations and opportunities that group continues to meet regularly. There was also a kind of a dispersed or fragmented network of people who were involved in food justice that, you know, were having various challenges in terms of some were urban farmers, some were community-based organizations, some were culinary professionals. And so we were able to create an opportunity to form a Black Farmers Food Justice, Food Sovereignty Collective. And that group came together and actually was able to secure land in the Yesler Terrace to have a sizable urban farm.
And why is it important for you to stay here specifically? Why not, you know, move to a new community?
Well, I don't know how people just move to a new community, but it's all about preservation and development and growing the seeds that have been planted by previous generations, building on the accomplishments. I mean, that's how all communities or societies, you know, move forward, is by each generation taking it further. You look at, say, like a Nordstrom's, each generation of the family added on, and not only within Seattle, but, you know, took it to a national or multinational enterprise. And so those same type of opportunities, which have been kind of restricted historically in certain communities, we want to make sure that everyone is able to participate in the opportunity and prosperity of the future that the city and many leaders speak about as far as equitable development and shared prosperity. And so we think Black Dot is a critical opportunity to move things in that direction. A big part of Black Dot is not bringing innovation to the community, but understanding that there's a legacy of innovation in this community. When you think about, you know, what Jimi Hendrix did with the guitar, and, you know, Quincy Jones being here, and many other, you know, examples of innovative entrepreneurial spirit, but it's disconnected from the current, you know, innovation economy or the tech, you know, sectors.
What personally motivates you to keep doing this work, to be a community organizer? I mean, I'm someone who's moved a lot. I don't really have a community. You've lived here your whole life. You feel, it seems like you're so invested in this place. What keeps you doing that work?
Well, I'm a product of community, for one, and I have children, and, you know, their environment is going to influence them. So I think it's important to, you know, do all that can be done to create the world that we want to live in, create a world that the next generation can flourish and be their best selves in. I guess there's a saying that, you know, service is the rent we pay. And so nothing, you know, that comes to us is a product of us alone. And so it's just, you know, as it was given, you know, so can we give. And we just keep, you know, passing it on and striving to make a contribution that makes things better.
A number of political and organizational formations, and one of them, and a very interesting development, what is happening over the weekend, is the launch of the Black First, Land First in Soweto. And joining us on the line is Andile Mqitama. Andile, thank you very much for making time to speak to us. Good morning, sir.
Yes, good morning to you and your listeners.
Andile, we're seeing interesting developments tomorrow happening in Soweto, the launch of the Black First, Land First. For those who might not be aware and understand, what actually is the ideology behind the movement, and what should one expect at the launch?
The theme of our launch is Black Agenda for Black Liberation. We are a movement that takes seriously the philosophy of Black consciousness and Pan-Africanism, and we are a Blacks-only movement because we believe after 22 years of democracy, Black people have not been liberated. We're still at the bottom of everything. I mean, if you look at land ownership, if you look at the economy, it's shocking that only 3% of the JSE is represented by Black people. The same goes for unemployment, poverty. There is no solution to the Black problem, if you like, which was not our creation, because there is no Black agenda and there is no centralization of Black interest. And so we believe that this is the time that we correct this so that we can retain our land and to bring a true liberation and dignity to Black people. Basically, we are following the ideas of Robert Sobukwe and Steve Biko, and we believe that power must be exercised, as an example said by Thomas Sankara. We are a Sankarist movement as well. So we're going to present this movement and present an agenda, this black agenda.
Whenever one says blacks only, Andy, and I'm sure you know, and this is a response that you would get to say, but are you excluding other races, and does that not make you racist? The difference between pro-black and anti-white comes up.
Yeah, and we say we are black consciousness. Therefore, our definition of black is inclusive of all the oppressed people, the so-called African, colored Indians are part of the black. The people who benefited from our oppression continue to benefit from the oppression and exclusion of black people are white people in this country. White people arrived in 1652 and have caused havoc in the lives of black people. That's why we're in the township squatter camps. That's why even judges today sitting in high court can say the things they say about us, precisely because of the racist system. And racism, it's about the oppression of black people by white people. Black people cannot be racist. I mean, this idea that if we say blacks only affects white people is crazy. I mean, it's like men in this patriarchal society saying that the women who are victims of patriarchy can't organize those women to liberate themselves. It's untenable.
Yeah. And with the launch tomorrow, Andila, we're expecting that Black First, Land First is going to be competing in the local government elections at all?
There's a big debate and discussion amongst us. I must report that. There is a large voice within our movement which is totally opposed to any engagement with the electoral process. It's a very articulate voice, and it says that the elections corrupt, it makes us politicians, and it makes us liars. There is, however, a voice which has been expressed particularly by the leadership of the movement that we must participate in the electoral processes and under the idea of anti-politics political engagement. We want to use politics to end politics. We are not trying to enter politics to become politicians. That space created must be exploited, must be used, and to expose the system further and to stretch it to its limits so that we can bring about a new dispensation. So these two ideas are going to be debated, and a decision would be made that whether we participate or not. As I say, we have a proposal as the leadership of the movement that we should participate in the coming elections and in the bourgeois process.
There's a few minutes left of the show, Andy, and I'm going to ask that we allow some questions because I'm getting a couple of calls coming in with just a few minutes left. 021-446-0567 and 011-883-0702. Andile Mkritama joining us on the line. He's from the Black First, Land First. They're launching tomorrow, and you're more than welcome to engage in the discussion with him. And Bruce is in Somerset West. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning. I take a bit of an umbrage at the current call or the gentleman on the line saying that it's for blacks only, because there are a lot of whites, of which I'm one, who's looking at the current system and who are challenging it and saying that there has not been a proper upliftment. And the question which I'm asking seems to be what he's echoing, and it's a question I'm asking politicians all the time, is tell me how the life of the masses is better now than what it was then. Yes, the apartheid system was wrong. But at the moment, you still sit with lots of people in poverty. You still sit with a lot of people who have the vote, but they have not been really liberated and are sitting in a better position, be it financially, with the medical system, with all that kind of jazz. And for him to say that it's a black-only movement, he's excluding a lot of people who also fought the apartheid government, and he stood against the apartheid government and said, you know what, that is wrong. And there are a lot of people who were, you know, again, who are white, who were fighting against what the apartheid government was doing. And I think he's excluding a lot of people who could possibly buy into his cause.
Okay. Bruce in Somerset West. Andile, your views there.
If Bruce is genuine about working for black liberation, he has to admit the first truth that both colonialism, apartheid, white supremacy, and democracy has served white people, not black people. And we have white people who, by the way, agrees with us. And our advice to them has been the following. They need to form white-only organizations, and them among themselves go and tell those who stole our land and continue to oppress and be racist that they need to stop all that. And the best form of reparation and forgiveness is to return the stolen land. They, white people, must do it. Why are they coming to join us to deal with a problem which, by the way, was not created by us? That's what Steve Biko did, and we are following Steve Biko. We're saying, white people, if you are out there, you really want change, you recognize you benefited unjustly from the oppression of black people, it is really up to you to take up struggles amongst yourself to make sure that black people are liberated. And we will come and tell you, Bruce, we want some money, and we will use it the way we want it. We don't want to hear your voice about what to do with it.
Andile, we need to make time to engage a whole lot more. We are completely out of time. Land First, Blank First, launching tomorrow.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are black.
Folks, this photo here at West Point is causing considerable consternation and has now led to an investigation. 16 black women, 16 female cadets, raised their fists while posed in uniform for what is a traditional old corpse photo at the West Point. The inquiry is to determine if these young women broke the rules, and some say breaching a Defense Department policy that says, quote, members on active duty should not engage in partisan political activity. Now, after the picture was posted on the Army Times website, several people questioned if the picture was in support of the Black Lives Matter movement or a salute to the 1968 Olympic medal sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos, or just 16 black women with their damn fist raised. Really, what's going on here? Others say the young cadets were merely celebrating their upcoming graduation on May 21st. Here to talk about this via Skype is a mentor to some of those young ladies and a 2003 West Point graduate, Mary Tobin. Mary, so explain this. First of all, I read another story by one of the board of advisors, a woman on the board of advisors, who said on this day, West Point students take different photos in different poses that sort of recreate old photos.
Yes, thank you, Roland, for having me here this morning to tell the other side of the story. Yes, the old core photos, you can take many different versions, right? So that photo with the fist raised was just one of three. They took one, a very stoic photo with their sabers, no smiling, no particular gestures. They took a more goofy, lighthearted photo in which they're laughing. And that's very, very common, in which you might take a picture with mascots, you might take a picture with a beach ball. And then they chose a third photo, which I fully believe was a symbol of pride and unity with their 16 sisters. I don't understand how anyone could look at that picture outside of the Corps cadets and decide that these women were a part of some subversive movement or any political alignment.
Well, and the thing is, say that it's a political statement, how do you even get that? Because it's not tied to Democrats or Republicans. This is somebody making a subjective decision. I mean, first of all, raising your fist, okay, that could be tied to any number of things. That's not a political statement.
Absolutely, Roland. Absolutely. We have teams and clubs and moments in time in which we celebrate so many different events at West Point in which the entire Corps cadets raises their fist. I can understand how one outside of the Corps cadets may think so, but you have to look at the whole perspective, and that's what I've been saying. This is a case of cultural ignorance. You have to look at the whole perspective. These young ladies, they turned down scholarships at some of the most elite schools in the country to attend West Point. We were taught for 4 years the regulations around any connections to a political movement, any connections to a particular party or candidate. And to think that in one snapshot, 3 weeks away from graduation, these women would put all of that on the line just to make a statement? Absolutely not. It's beyond the realm of comprehension. And it was a symbol of pride and unity.
What does it say that if you're black and you raise your fist, you scare the hell out of white folks?
We say that West Point is a reflection of the American society. because that's exactly what it is. West Point has a dark discriminatory past. We don't try to necessarily hide from it, but it's there. And we don't talk about it because we put the mission of developing leaders of character and honor in the greatest military in the world. We put that mission first. However, we are still Black in a predominantly white institution, a sea of white men, and we have 16 Black women who did it, who outlasted men and women, Black and white, and yet we still cannot simply be looked at as Black women officers. We have to be looked at as Black women who are trying to subvert the system and somehow tear down 214 years of time-honored tradition. It's beyond me.
I want to go to our panel, Barbara Arnwine, founding president of the Transformative Justice Coalition, Gianna Caldwell, Republican strategist, and Carmen Berkeley, civil, human, and women's rights director at the AFL-CIO. They're investigating. I'm trying to figure out, Barbara, what are they investigating?
It's just outrageous. First of all, they don't desegregate on the basis of sex until 1977. Then they have the nerve to take Black women. You know, sometimes I think just being a Black woman in this society is a political statement. That people just see us, and whatever we do, it gets interpreted in a political way. Remember that when Howard, when Harvard, when all the schools were making statements about Black Lives Matter, what was the gesture? It was hands up, don't shoot. Let's get it straight here. These people are ignorant. They ought to be ashamed of themselves. It really calls into question the entire administration at West Point. And Black women, let's make our voices known on this. We're not going to let these sisters take a fall for nothing that makes sense. And Black men, we need you too.
Carmen, 80% of the 70% of the students at West Point, white. 80% are men. This also reminds me of when the Army did not allow certain hairstyles that Black women said,
"Wait, braids,
it makes it better."
Yeah,
and they finally changed that. But it was, I mean, it was a whole lot of drama over that as well.
You know what, Barbara's right. Anything that we do as Black women is seen as being political. When I saw that photo, I didn't see Black militancy. I saw Black girl magic. And so I think in our country, Black patriotism means something to us because our history is not sunshine and rainbows. Our history is about discrimination. So us putting up our fist is a sense of pride. That's what Black patriotism means. And I'm actually really happy that those are the women that will be fighting on the front lines to save my Black life.
Thank Gianna?
I think Ms. Tobin articulately stated her point in terms of what this really means. When I looked at the photo, I thought it was Black unity. I didn't think that it was anything political. As a former federal employee who understands the Hatch Act, this wouldn't be something that would merit an investigation, in my opinion, and I agree with the ladies on the panel. I do believe that when people see African-American women and men make statements like this right fist, they make it something political, which I don't believe in this case it was.
Mary, a final comment?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that this West Point administration is probably the most progressive and evolved that I've ever seen. They've not shied away from the issues. However, West Point is a reflection of American society. So if there's sexism, racism, homophobia, then there will be that within the Corps of Cadets. I'll say that this is just a part. This is just a start of the discussion. And I thank everyone for their support. Let's keep pushing back and supporting these women, because in just a few weeks, they'll go out into the military in a time of war, and there'll be leaders of our nation's sons and daughters. That's what's important, that 16 out of 1,000 graduated from West Point.
All right, then, Mary Tobin and West Point, this is real simple. If you in hand-to-hand combat, I'm sure you want to see these sisters do this. You want to see them do this and then doing this to somebody else. And so I say this here to all the sisters at West Point, y'all hold it down, stay strong, stay Black, and give them hell. All right, Mary, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
I am not prejudiced.
Jermaine J. Cornegay is running to be a Hillary Clinton delegate. She wants to go to the Democratic National Convention this July in Philadelphia. She's originally from Philly, but in 2013, she was elected to the Cedro Woolley City Council, the first and only African-American in the city's 115-plus year history. KUOW's David Hyde has more.
Back when Jermaine Cornegay ran for office and she campaigned door to door.
I was invited in for soup, for dinner, for tea, asked questions.
Almost everyone she met and everything she experienced was pretty great, except this one time.
He stepped out on a porch, maybe about 4 inches from my face, and I watched his wife looking out of the window. And the first thing out of his mouth was, I will never vote for you because you're black. That's the first thing he said to me. I just said to myself that I'm really going to learn something from this man. I'm going to sit here and listen, and I'm going to learn from it. And then I'm going to use it to motivate myself to win this election. And he went on for a good 10 minutes about how African-Americans can never do anything good. And he even finished off by saying that I wish you'd go back where you came from.
Go back to Africa?
And all I could think is I would love to go to Africa, but I'd love a round trip ticket, too.
Why did you decide to stand there and just listen to that?
Because he himself during the conversation admitted that he hated being a bigot. He hated that about himself. And I thought that it was extremely telling that he was being so honest. And I much prefer someone being that honest with me than someone that's doing it behind my back. And I learned a lot from him, actually. I learned a lot. Now, me and him have mutual friends. And those friends have told me that he really appreciated that I listened to him and heard him out, and that he wished he hadn't done that, and he was really embarrassed. I mean, so I feel like that's kind of the way you change people's minds, is you have to let them get to know you. You can't run away from it.
That story makes me curious to know more about Cedro Woolley. How many African Americans serve on your city council?
None, except for this one. I didn't realize that when I was running that I was going to be the first person of color ever elected in Cedro Woolley's history. But I was looking at it as I'm going to be the first woman on a council in a long time. And it didn't dawn on me until election night when a reporter asked me what that felt like to be the first person of color ever elected to the city of Cedro Woolley for any position.
So you didn't know. You didn't even know.
I had no idea.
What was your answer to that question?
I literally burst into tears. I didn't even have an answer. It didn't even hit me until just that moment, and I burst into tears. Luckily for me, I was standing next to another council member, and I just cried right into his shoulder. I was shocked, and I had my daughter with me, which was even more amazing. It was just shocking because at the time, I had lived there for about 11 years. I felt like I was like everyone else because that's just how I was treated. It's kind of funny being in Cedro Woolley. And I feel like a lot of people don't want to move to Cedro Woolley because they feel like it's too conservative and it's too closed off. And I never felt that. Matter of fact, I just love the way I'm treated in Cedro Woolley.
So, but what's the significance of that for you, being the first?
I'm hoping it opens the doors for others.
Well, let's get to wanting to be a Hillary Clinton delegate. You're a Hillary supporter. Why Hillary?
I absolutely adore Hillary. In 2008, I was not in Hillary's camp. I was more in Senator Obama's camp. But since then, I've been watching her career. I feel like she is just so qualified and so amazing on every level. As a women's rights advocate, there's just no way not to support her. And what she does for women, I mean, there's been lots of times where I've seen women have good ideas and men get the credit. And that's fine. But now it's time for us to notice that that's what's been happening and to maybe put women in more power positions. And what's better than the president of the United States?
Jermaine J. Cornegay is a city council member in Cedro Woolley. She's running to be a Hillary Clinton delegate from Washington State. I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
But they don't have laws for people at night when cops accidentally shoot people. I mean, they accidentally shoot more niggas out here than any place in the world. Every time you pick up a paper, nigga accidentally shot in the ass. How do you accidentally shoot a nigga six times in the chest? Like, well, my gun fell and just went crazy.
We have been talking a lot on this program about a man named Andrew Loku, a 45-year-old father of five, who was shot and killed in his apartment by Toronto police last summer. Well, we know that the Special Investigations Unit, which investigates situations like that, they came out with a report. And that report said that the officer who shot and killed Mr. Loku would not be charged. We know that that triggered mass protests from Black Lives Matter and many other groups in the city of Toronto. And that since that time, Mayor John Tory and Premier Kathleen Wynne and many others have promised more accountability for the police and more public conversations about policing. Now, I write a column every week in the Toronto Star, and I wrote one about this situation this week because I found out some new information, which I believe I was the first person to publish. And I do highly recommend that you check out this week's column in the Toronto Star. I'm always feeling very lucky to have that position, but what I wrote this week was one of the most important columns that I've ever written. There is a video that was taken from Andrew Locu's apartment on the night that he was shot and killed by the police. There are two video cameras in the hallway where he was standing when the police came up the stairs and confronted Mr. Locu before one of them shot him twice in the chest. I spoke this past week to a fellow named Steve Lurie. Steve Lurie is the executive director of the Canadian Mental Health Association. And the Canadian Mental Health Association actually leases out most of the units in the building where Andrew Locu lived. In fact, the Canadian Mental Health Association was leasing out his unit to him. And they provide supportive housing for people who have mental illness, which is one of the reasons that this story is so sad, is that the police would go into a building like that and kill someone who they believed was angry, but really who could have just been in distress or surprised that the police were pointing guns at him. It was a sad story all around. But when I talked to Steve Lurie, he told me something that I had to report on. Steve Lurie has viewed what video exists from the night that Andrew Locu was shot and killed. And although there's a couple of very crucial minutes of that encounter that are not on the video, and those are the minutes when Andrew Locu is actually shot and killed, those don't appear on the video. But what does appear on the video is what happens right afterwards. And what happens right afterwards is that the police can be seen standing over Mr. Locu. The police can be seen standing over Mr. Locu for 10 minutes. And at about 11 minutes, the police begin to perform CPR on Andrew Locu. The police say that the reason that they didn't perform CPR on a man who they had just shot twice in the chest for 10 minutes was that he was still alive and still conscious. But it certainly doesn't sound like that from Steve Lurie, who's seen the video. And the reason that this distresses me so much is because I've seen the video footage of Eric Garner, a black man who was choked out by police in New York City on the street. And even though there were seven police officers there who know life-saving techniques, none of them tried to help Eric Garner. I know that Mike Brown, a black man who was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, was left to lie in a pool of his own blood for 4.5 hours. And he wasn't taken away in an ambulance after that. He was taken away in a police vehicle. I know that Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old black boy, was shot and killed by an officer in Cleveland, and that the officer and his partner again stood there over Tamir Rice's body instead of giving him life-saving techniques. And I know that Walter Scott, a black man who was shot and killed while running away from a police officer, shot in the back. In that case, the police officer told his unit that he actually did try to do CPR on Walter Scott, but he didn't know that somebody was filming it. And the film clearly shows that he didn't try to help. I'm not going to mince words. I think that the reason that black people are getting shot and killed by the police in the ways that we are is that the police are afraid of us. They're more afraid of us than they are of other civilians in the population. But whether or not the police are afraid, they have a duty to care for somebody in that situation. And if we could hear the testimony which has been taken out of that report on Andrew Locu, of the police officers and of other people, we could actually know what happened. We wouldn't have to take the police's word for it or Steve Lurie's word for it from the CMHA who has seen the video. And this is why it's so important that that video be published so that all of us can see it and that the testimony of everyone who was there that night be published. And we will continue asking for it on this program because it's that important. Billy, how-
holiday. I sing your blues. Bet your life against me, and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Nearly 2 years after a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, killed an unarmed black teenager, the city has a new police chief. Today is the first day on the job for Delrish Moss. He grew up in Miami and spent his entire career with the police force there, most recently as its spokesperson. When I spoke with Chief Moss earlier today, he told me he chose Ferguson over retiring to the beach, partly because the challenges of Ferguson remind him of the problems Miami faced when he was a kid. And he told me those problems helped lead him to become a police officer 32 years ago.
You know, I took the job as a police officer after having a couple of negative experiences with police officers. One was where I was sitting on a bus stop and a police officer comes up. He starts to search my bag. He searches me and he tells me, you, N-word, shouldn't walk downtown after dark.
He used the N-word.
He used the N-word.
Nigga!
And I had another experience where I was walking down the street. Police officer just pushes me up against a wall, starts to search me and everything else. And then he jumps in his car and he leaves and he never said a word. Never did anything to restore my dignity, never explained why he treated me in such a fashion. And both those things actually started my curiosity with the police profession, and I decided that I needed to become a police officer so that I could provide better services to my community than we seem to be getting.
And you are now taking charge of a police force that has some of those same problems you've described, and worse. I mean, the Justice Department found deep-seated patterns of racial discrimination among the Ferguson police. It is a largely white police force. You are black. How do you plan to begin addressing these problems?
Well, I think the first thing I need to do is a really comprehensive assessment of all of the things that are happening, because the Justice Department has its view. And, you know, certainly those are the real stories and experiences of people who live in Ferguson. But there are things here that I need to see for myself in order to get a real grasp of what the challenges are going to be and how to move it forward. You know, everyone thinks they have the silver bullet, if you will, or the magic pill to fix things. But until you're on the ground, you really can't get a full grasp of the direction you need to go in.
Having decided to come to Ferguson rather than spend time on the beach in Miami, you must have some sense of what you want to bring to the job and what kinds of changes you want to make. What do you have in mind?
Well, there are a few things. I want a police department that's much more community friendly. I want the community to feel like this is a place of refuge and where they have a stake at what's happening within the police department. This is not us or. This is both and. And I think that the police department has to understand that it's the community that sets its priorities and how you police it. And so I want to make sure that we're much more community friendly. But we want to be much more open and transparent in terms of how we deliver our services and what people expect from us.
Ferguson is in a tough financial position. You don't have a lot of spare money to work with.
You know, there's not a lot of money to work with, and that's true. And certainly there were two tax referendums. One passed, the other didn't. And so that does present some challenges. But I don't think that everything requires money to fix. You know, some basic things, like if you hearken back to my experience with that latter police officer, if he had just taken the time to explain to me why he confronted me the way he did, and if he had just taken the time to restore my dignity, my view of that experience would have been wholeheartedly different than it was all these years later, where I still don't have answers.
It's interesting. Some people having a run-in like that would probably make them want to run as far as they could from the police force, and it made you want to join up. Why is that? What do you think that says about you?
Well, I think that the reality is that my community was going to be there, and the other reality was that the police were going to be there, and so those services needed to be provided. And I figured that if I wasn't a part of a solution, then I certainly wasn't offering anything. So I decided that I needed to become a police officer to provide my community with better services than they were getting, because they were obviously going to get services. I just needed to be a part of making sure they were good services.
I know this is only day one, but so far, have you been received by the rank-and-file police officers? What are you hearing from them?
So far, the rank-and-file police officers are all coming up to me, and obviously they want to know who I am and what I bring to the table. They want to know what their future is with regard to the police department. So it's kind of hard to gauge what that perception or a reception is. But from the community, it's been wholeheartedly welcoming. People have been very friendly, and they've offered me lots of help now. Of course, there have been naysayers. There have been some protesters who plan to protest even my swearing in to let me know that their voices need to be heard. And you know what? I respect that wholeheartedly. I need to hear what they have to say, because it's only when I listen to them can I start to make some positive change.
And how do you plan to do that? Community meetings, town hall gatherings? What's your approach?
Actually, all of the above. I mean, everything from staff walks where my staff and my supervisors get out and we knock on doors and we go house to house and we go business to business and we talk to people and we find out what their challenges are. Not only what their challenges are, but what's your perception of the police department and why? Because I think once we get that full comprehensive understanding, we can move Ferguson in a really positive direction.
Well, Chief Delrish-Moss, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Delrish-Moss is the new chief of police in Ferguson, Missouri.
You know, I've always wanted to be a cop.
A new study of recent police data finds significant racial disparities in traffic stops in some of Connecticut's police departments. Researchers at Central Connecticut State University used a combination of six analytical tools to review hundreds of thousands of traffic stops. The new study shows stops of minority drivers were more likely to happen during the day, quote, when a driver's race and ethnicity are visible. Michael Lawler is the governor's undersecretary for criminal justice issues. He spoke at a meeting of the Connecticut Racial Profiling Prohibition Project's advisory board where the report was presented.
This is just data. This is not a verdict. This is not a determination of who's guilty of what. This is simply real data being gathered in real time from real law enforcement agencies. But the purpose of this project is not to decide whether or not anyone's actually being unfair. It's simply to present real data so that policy decisions are made based on evidence and data instead of anecdotes.
Based on the analysis, nine municipal departments and one state police troop will get further review because of the disparities in their data. New Milford, Norwalk, West Hartford, Wethersfield, Bloomfield, Meriden, Newington, Trumbull, Windsor, and Troop H. The 292-page report makes several points. One has to do with what's called the veil of darkness. The question is, do racial and ethnic minorities get pulled over more frequently when their race or ethnicity can be plainly seen? Ken Barone is a researcher who prepared the report.
The results indicated a statistically significant disparity for Hispanic drivers in the state of Connecticut as a whole. And also for when we combine both black and Hispanic drivers together, the statistical disparity remains strong.
Barone also said the data explains how racial disparities exist in searches of cars after their stop.
Minorities are searched more often, contraband is found less. White drivers are searched less often, contraband is found more.
Finally, the report talked about so-called discretionary stops, such as when an officer pulls someone over for a busted taillight. That data particularly bothered Dr. Kato Lorenzen, a physician and UConn professor, who's on the project's advisory board.
My belief is that in terms of these discretionary stops, they have to become non-discretionary, meaning either everybody stop for it, or you do it doing a roadblock, or don't do it at all. But clearly, where there's discretion that's involved, that's where racial discrimination can take place. And I think the data really bears that out.
Lorenzen underscored another reason for urgency. He said there's evidence that racial discrimination is a source of health disparities. Douglas Fuchs is the chief of the Reading Police Department. He represents the Connecticut Chiefs of Police Association. And he told the board that he values the project, but it has its flaws.
Most will agree that judging one's ethnicity as they drive by you at 40 miles an hour is a very difficult thing to do.
But Fuchs did say the police were unwaveringly in support of the project.
Every police chief in Connecticut remains committed to the law, but more importantly to the principle that stopping an individual based solely on what they look like is completely unacceptable and is certainly illegal. Our expectation is that our officers are stopping violators who represent a virtual mirror image of who's actually driving on our roadways.
You can read the full report as well as our series on racial disparities and traffic stops at WNPR.org.
See my side of town, anything can go down. Whether it's raps or slinger gaps, we putting Bronx on the map. Look,
Scaramucci, a Bronx nigga.
McKenzie,
a Bronx nigga.
Kevin Jones,
a Bronx nigga.
Now, the Bronx court system has been heavily scrutinized in recent years for its failure to provide those charged with all levels of crimes
their constitutional right to a speedy trial. The office holds the title as the worst in the city in delays regarding resolving cases. Almost 3 years ago, the New York Times published a scathing series that delved into the dysfunction of the Bronx courts, stating, quote, "The Bronx criminal courts have become a place where delay and dysfunction are the norm and central ideas of the American justice system, especially the promise of a speedy trial, have been disgracefully subverted," unquote. And almost a year ago, as many of you know, the Bronx judicial system drew national ire after the death of Kalief Browder, the 22-year-old who committed suicide after spending 3 years at Rikers, only to have his case thrown out for a lack of evidence, and that was a small charge. Yet little has changed. As of January of this year, there were over 2,000 misdemeanor cases in the Bronx pending for more than a year, and upwards of 500 cases pending for over 2 years, according to the Bronx Defenders, which provides help to lower-income residents. Here's the news. The organization is filing a lawsuit in federal district court in Manhattan today, seeking to reform the delays in misdemeanor trials and get the court to force it. Governor Cuomo is a defendant named in this suit. The state's chief judge, Janet DeFiore, is a defendant named in this suit. So is Lawrence K. Marks, the court system's chief administrative judge, all defendants named in this lawsuit being filed today. So joining me now are Robin Steinberg, executive director of the Bronx Defenders, and Ilan Mazel, a partner with Emery Selly Brinkerhoff and Abadi LLP, law firm, co-counsel in the case, along with the law firm Morrison & Forster. So welcome back to WNYC, Robin Steinberg. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
And welcome to WNYC, Ilan Mazel.
Nice to be here, Brian.
What are the most common misdemeanor crimes, Robin, that many of these defendants are charged with, facing these extended delays?
The misdemeanor crimes are low-level drug possession, marijuana, trespass, minor assaults, jumping a turnstile, those kinds of offenses.
Ilan, what's a fancy law firm like you doing in a case like this?
Well, we're a law firm devoted to protecting civil rights, and the right to a speedy trial is a very important civil right. We have people who are languishing in the Bronx criminal court for many, many years, just trying to get their day in court, and that's wrong.
And Robin, how do these delays affect the lives of these defendants while they await trial?
So the delays not only undermine the legitimacy of the entire system, it extracts an enormous human toll on our clients. They miss work, they lose wages, they miss school, they have to scramble for childcare, and they have to live with the pressure and the fear of having a criminal case hanging over their head month after month, year after year.
Is there ever a scenario, Ilan, where a defendant is awaiting trial in jail for a misdemeanor charge?
It's rare, but it does happen. But usually misdemeanor defendants, they have to come to court day after day, sometimes 10 times, sometimes 20 times, sometimes over 30 times just to get a trial date. And it's enormously disruptive to their lives.
Robin, have delays in the Bronx courts improved at all since the New York Times story 3 years ago and the death of Kalief Browder also highlighted the system's dysfunction for a wider public?
Unfortunately, they have not. And in fact, in misdemeanor cases, they've gotten worse, which leads people to have to face this unconscionable choice, right? They either come back and forth to court knowing the disruption and the instability and the pressure that causes on them and their families and their lives month after month, year after year. And the only way to stop that from happening is then to plead guilty to something that they probably shouldn't plead guilty to begin with.
So, Ilan, if this lawsuit is successful, what would it force the governor or anyone else to do about this?
Well, certainly the court system needs more funding, and funding needs to be allocated towards the Bronx Criminal Court. I mean, this is the poorest county in New York State, and they have these enormous delays. Your right to a speedy trial should not depend on your zip code, and that's the way it is today.
Robin, you want to continue on that? What would the lawsuit accomplish if successful?
Well, I certainly agree with my co-counsel. There is a perfect storm here in the Bronx. There's gross underfunding of the Bronx criminal system. There's an inefficient use of already existing resources. There's poor management of calendars in the courthouse itself. And you add on that last year over 45,000 people were brought into the criminal justice system here in the Bronx. That combination has led to an intractable delay.
By comparison, and this will also make your eyes pop out, in 2014, I see, the misdemeanor arraignments in Bronx criminal court were significantly fewer than the number of case filings in Manhattan or Brooklyn or Queens, fewer misdemeanor charges.
And yet Bronx Criminal Court had more misdemeanor cases pending at the end of the year. The last time citywide comparative data had more misdemeanor cases pending at the end of the year in 2013, which is the last year for which citywide comparative data was publicly available. So fewer cases, more cases unresolved. In fact, the Bronx had more misdemeanor cases pending in excess of a year than the four other boroughs combined. So, Robin, why is the Bronx such an outlier?
Well, I think it's for the reasons that we've already talked about, which is that, you know, the Bronx is the poorest borough in New York City. It has the highest minority population. It's the poorest county in the state. And quite frankly, the South Bronx is the poorest congressional district in the entire country. It's been overlooked. It's been underfunded. There hasn't been enough attention paid to it. And we are bringing many, 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 many residents of the Bronx through the criminal justice system on very minor offenses. All of that is combining together to create a sort of a perfect storm of horribles. The other comparative thing that's interesting is in the Bronx, if you ask for a jury trial, meaning you demand your right to a day in court to have the evidence brought against you and challenge what government is charging you with, it takes approximately 827 days to get a jury trial in the Bronx. If you compare that to the other boroughs, that's 99% higher than in Manhattan, 66% higher than in Brooklyn, and 48% higher than in Queens. So the Bronx is clearly an outlier, and everybody knows it.
Elon, do you want to add to that? I mean, who makes these funding decisions? The poverty in the Bronx relative to other boroughs shouldn't translate into funding per defendant, less funding per defendant in the criminal court system. It's not determined by a local tax on the local poor people, right?
That's exactly right. And there is a culture of delay in the Bronx, and that's a big problem. They just aren't getting the attention they should get. Just to add to what Robin said, 827 days to get to a jury trial. You could bring three babies to term before getting your day in court. That's messed up, and that's a legal term. That is crazy. It's an astonishing number, and that's something we have to address. We can't allow people in our city to be waiting year after year just to get their day in court.
Let's take another call. Here is, let's see, David in Teaneck. You're on WNYC. Hello, David.
Hey. How are you doing?
All right.
All right. Great show. I had a question for the two people that you have there. Recently, there was an article that came out in the Huffington Post about the war on drugs, and John Ehrlichman, who was Richard Nixon's domestic policy chief, had said in an interview with David Baum that the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. And one of the things that Ehrlichman said was that they couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or blacks, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing them both heavily, they could disrupt those communities.
You're going way. Even if Ehrlichman said those things, which I don't know if he would have said those things so explicitly like that, even if he believed them, but what does that have to do with the Bronx today?
Well, I'm just trying to see. It seems that the slow pace of these cases, the speedy trials, but also the disruption of all these families. Like, there are cases like this that were happening in Ferguson, which resembled a RICO type of case where, you know, there are ways to tax the lower-income blacks in that community. And it seems like this is something that's being duplicated in New York. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if, while you're doing your legal work, are you making connections or seeing connections with a pattern across the country, and which law enforcement officials, judges, are you keeping tabs on the people that are involved so that there's like a tally on how this is being done?
Interesting question. So in Ferguson, we know the Justice Department did document that they were using massive misdemeanor violations as tax revenue generation for that suburb of St. Louis. Do you see anything like that going on in the Bronx? Is there any parallel, Robin Steinberg, in your view, or is this just a much more inadvertent situation?
Well, I think it does raise the question about when you're bringing 45,000 people in the Bronx into the court system on minor offenses every year, and those offenses are being conducted in every community around our city, but really are only being policed in low-income communities of color. It raises the questions, I think the broader questions, about why are we bringing people from this community into the criminal justice system in those numbers, and certainly that's a contributing factor to the delay.
Hey, sucker nigga, whoever you are. Hey, sucker nigga, whoever you are. Hey, sucker nigga, hey, sucker nigga, whoever you are, whoever you are.
New at 10, San Francisco's Municipal Transportation Agency says it has suspended a Muni bus driver after he's seen on video using a racial slur. KTU's Amber Lee live now in the city after speaking with Muni about the incident. Amber.
Julie, a woman sent a cell phone video showing a man in Muni uniform making racial slurs. She tells us the remarks were directed at her friend who had taken a parking space that the man wanted.
Okay, okay.
At first, you hear a man's voice coming from a white car.
I was waiting. It's just a nigger. That's okay. That's fine.
I'm on what?
Nigger!
I'm not even black.
It doesn't matter. Your mentality is nigger.
Okay.
The video shows the white four-door sedan the man was driving. SFMTA confirmed that he drives a bus for Muni and has been employed with the transit agency less than 2 years. A spokesman for Muni says the white car the man was driving is his personal vehicle.
When we saw it, I think we were all disturbed. I mean, it's a shocking video.
Muni says it received the videos via social media. You can clearly see the male driver wearing a Muni uniform.
Sir, this is downtown. If you see a spot, you take
it.
Yeah.
In a separate video, the man makes another offensive remark at the woman.
Real gangbanger.
Yeah, I see your mentality too, sir. Have a good day, sir.
We obtained a letter that Muni's director of transit wrote to staff addressing this incident. Quote, there is simply no acceptable excuse or mitigating circumstances to justify his actions, and we have moved to terminate his employment at the agency. The woman is further heard telling the man he has his information.
Are you threatening me?
No.
Okay, well, I have your license plate, and I have your face.
We take this very seriously, and that's why we're taking the necessary action in this matter.
I spoke with the president of the Transport Workers Union, which represents Muni drivers. He told me, as a black man, I am offended. Our union does not condone this. Our members are made up of people from different cultures and backgrounds. Muni tells me it hopes to complete its investigation quickly so it can take swift action. Live in San Francisco, Amber Lee, KTVU, Fox 2 News.
Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That is the interaction with black people and white people every day, wherever they happen to be. It's going to be one of those categories, a combination of all three, before the day is over. But it doesn't get any better than tacky. I call it the three T's. Tacky, trashy, terroristic. That's it. Anywhere on the planet you are.
We've all lived in apartment buildings where we've had to deal with certain tenants that might engage in really loud sex. But what happens when that loud sex becomes threatening? That's what happened for one family in Pennsylvania, where a couple and their five children had to deal with one couple having loud sex that was so disruptive that it impacted the kids in school, and it also threatened them because of what the couple was saying as they were engaged in sexual activities. Okay. So in April, the neighbor, Amanda Marie Warfel, 25, pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct and harassment charges for incidents that took place in February and March. So here's Amanda Marie, and she pleaded guilty to a lesser charge in order to have some of the more criminal charges dropped from her record. So those charges were reduced to non-traffic citations, a charge of ethnic intimidation originally filed against her in connection with the February 28th incident. Now, that February 28th incident charge was dropped. Now, let me give you the details of what happened. So they would engage in really loud sex. And this family was like, okay, well, let me knock and try to get them to quiet down. But that didn't work. In fact, that somehow encouraged Warfel to, can we just get Warfel out of the way? It's a weird name, right?
Warfel.
It sounds like you're trying to say
waffle, but you have like a weird accent that's
like
preventing
Washington.
Yeah. So anyway, so the mother of this family would knock on the wall that would share the shared wall, and the couple would just engage in louder and louder sex. And then finally they started saying threatening things about the daughters that were staying in the room that shared the wall. So I don't know exactly what the threats were, but they were really loud threats that apparently they provided evidence of when they went after this couple. And then they started attacking one of the girls, one of the daughters who's black, by calling her racial slurs as they were engaged in sex. This happened for 2 years. And finally, the family's like, we can't do this anymore. It got so bad that the cops would have to sign letters to the educators for these kids because they would have to come to school late. They wouldn't get enough sleep. They would end up sleeping too much, you know, sleeping in. And then the cops would have to, like, file a report for them, sign a letter for their teacher so they would get excused for their tardiness, their lateness. It's disastrous. I can't believe anyone would be this freaking cruel.
And one of the daughters had cancer and had to be quarantined, and her mother could not protect her from all of the loud harassment directed toward her for solid days at a time. And I think they were aware of this. Okay, sex is a beautiful thing, right? And some amount of sex is to be expected. If you live in an apartment, you don't live alone. It's you can't be that asshole who's just like, if someone takes a step, you go, shut up, I'm going to call the cops.
Right.
But it's just, this was so far beyond. This was targeted harassment. This was so unnecessary in so many ways.
To have this go on for years and years.
Years.
Like, what's wrong? What's wrong with you that you feel the need? Like, I get into some weird stuff, but I don't get into weird stuff where you're yelling racial epithets to kids with cancer.
That's true, yeah.
And it's like, it's so tough because if you're that neighbor, you're just like, at what point do I draw the line?
Mm-hmm. Like, at what point do I just let it go and move on with my life to something that is actually worth my time? But in the article, it says that the mother never saw Warfel.
Yeah.
Because she was cooped up all the time.
Yeah, yeah. She was too busy, like, recovering from all the intense.
We don't know if that's why she was cooped up. But
probably. She look at her mugshot. She looks so, like, she's sad she's not having sex.
I don't understand why anyone would be that insensitive. But apparently the family never saw her until the preliminary hearing. I'm glad that they went after her. I'm glad that they got a little bit of justice in this case. And I feel really sorry that they had to deal with this for 2 years. By the way, this family not only has a child who is suffering from cancer, the husband is also suffering from terminal cancer. And so it's just such a hideous story when you really put everything into context.
Context.
Looking at behavior in context. Now, whether he actually meant context, as I say it, I say the context is a system of racism, white supremacy.
Context. Of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, May 14th, 2016. So I have been told. Compensatory call in. Feel free to chime in. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We will be back tomorrow, our Sunday global talk on racism. It is 12 noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, early time. We should have folks tuning in from different parts of the world. If you are awake and not going to the house of the Lord, feel free to join us, share thoughts, observations, global perspective on racism, white supremacy. A few quick notes before I get to some of the folks who dialed in who have commentary. I did not play this in the audio segment, but I had been talking about this case for a good chunk of the year and telling folks that I was going to be remaining attentive to how this case unfolds. So if you remember the black female students at the State University of New York at Albany, Albany University, where they alleged, they reported that they had been racially harassed on a bus. I think it was a Saturday evening. They were on a bus. They said that some white passengers attacked them. It made the news. People were talking about it. And then the enforcement officials in New York filed charges against them for making a false report. They said they reviewed the surveillance footage from the bus and that these black female students were actually the instigators in the incident, and they charged them. The case, they had the arraignment earlier in the year. I guess they're supposed to go to trial and all that later on. So the university, they have, I guess, their own student conduct board, and so they conducted an investigation into this to decide if they were going to take punitive action. According to Business Insider, and this was reported on a few other sites as well, that two of these three black female students have been expelled, and the other student, she has been suspended for 2 years. Just, I thought that was extremely significant, just given the fact that this case has not been fully adjudicated yet. That I don't know what would happen with these sanctions from the university if this goes to trial and the charges are dismissed, and they reach a conclusion that, hey, they didn't do anything wrong, there was, you know, reasonable doubt or what have you, we find them innocent. I don't know how that will impact the student sanctions, but I thought that was extremely important. And I compare that to some of the, there have been so many other incidents, in my view, that are so much larger, where you have had explicit racial terrorism. The incident in San Jose State, where they were harassing a black male student, even the incident at the University of Oklahoma last year with Levi Pettit and the gang, where they were singing about lynching niggers and all this other stuff, where they got expelled, and you had so many people come out and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. Why are we expelling these young lads? They were just having a little bit of fun, and, you know, they just had a little bit too much to drink, and oh, this is horrible. This is political correctness run amok. I haven't really heard anyone come out to these three young black scholars' defense and say, you know, even if they did do something wrong, which hasn't been proven, this case is yet to be adjudicated, hey, you know, we jumped the gun on this thing. Let's you know, allow the law to run its course, and then we can make a decision if there needs to be any punitive action taken. But that's just one that I thought was important that took place this week. The second thing that I thought was really important, one of the latter clips that I played, it was the section from the Brian Lehrer Show, and they were talking about this backlog of cases in the Bronx, where they have lots and lots of non-white people, lots of black people, I presume, and it takes, sometimes it can take 3 years for your case to work its way through the legal system. Khalif Browder mentioned consistently. Now, in that segment, it was important in and of itself, but I thought it was especially important when Dave from TNEC called in and he asked his question relating what was happening in the Bronx to what happened in Ferguson, and he referenced the article by Dan Baum that was in Harper's earlier this year, where he talked about Nixon's staff member, John Ehrlichman, in the interview that I guess he did with him, where he said that the war on drugs was just basically out to get, quote-unquote, leftist people who were against the Vietnam War and black people. And so he quotes all of this, and Brian Lehrer, the suspected race soldier, the host of this segment on WNYC Public Radio, he interrupts him and says, oh, my gosh, you're gone way afield from what we're talking about, and I'm sure, I don't even know if Ehrlichman would say something like that. We don't know if that's true, and what does that have to do with what we're talking about anyway? The first thing is that, in my view, that is like massive act of white supremacy on Brian Lehrer's part, because not only did John Ehrlichman, he was quoted like verbatim, everything that the caller said about the whole war on drugs was just to get black people and leftists. This is quoted exactly in Dan Baum's article, quotation marks, the whole nine, in his article that was in Harper's just a few weeks ago. Not only that, this article has been widely discussed, not just on this program, but I mean
lots of people saw this and were like, wow, that's amazing. That it, I mean, he would just state it that bluntly. And I, in fact, I normally don't even curse. This is G-rated. But, I mean, just I heard the author. I played the segment where he was on WNYC, Dan Baum, and he said that John Ehrlichman told him, you know, can we stop bullshitting and let's just be clear? This was about, hey, let's get the Negroes. Let's get the black people. We could just show them on TV, associate them with drugs, and then we can go to town, do whatever we want to go out and attack black people. He said that's what he said. And I feel like white people do that sort of thing on a regular basis where they will suggest that whatever you're saying, you're just talking nonsense. You're just talking rubbish. Nobody said that. Nobody did this. You don't even know what you're talking about. It's just a great way to invalidate when a black person brings up a really good point generally related to white supremacy to just totally invalidate you, that you're just talking nonsense. We shouldn't take you seriously. Nobody should really pay attention and evaluate the question or statement that you're making. Major act of racism. And in addition to that, as I said, Dan Baum was on WNYC. Now, he wasn't on Brian Lehrer's program. He was on the Leonard Lopate show. But it's been my experience that these white folks, they pay attention when there's a major guest that is on their network, even if it's going to be one of their colleagues' shows, one of their colleagues doing the interview. I would have a hard time believing that Brian Lehrer, the person in the segment we played today, had no idea. He had never heard of this report in Harper's, no idea that the guy who wrote this report talking about this did this study in or did this article in Harper's Magazine that's gotten so much attention throughout 2016. I have a very difficult time believing that this is the first that he's heard of this, so he just thinks this is nonsense and something that cannot be believed. Final thing I wanted to make sure I got in, we had Dr. Amma Mazaa. She was on the program just a few weeks ago. She was talking about the importance of homeschooling black children, and she shared that she was going to be doing a workshop in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania later this month. It's going to be next Saturday. She has a flyer. I posted it on my Facebook pages, actually. I tweeted it out a couple days ago. It reads, Homeschooling Black Children, a Practical Workshop with Amma Mazaa, Barbara Ellis, and Nicole Jobson, three black homeschooling mothers who will share their experiences and expertise with you. Please come join us on Saturday, May 21st, 2016, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. They have the address. It's on the flyer. It's 5535 Germantown Avenue, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You can get the flyer if you need any information. If you're close to the Philadelphia area and you're down to road trip, I suspect this will be lots of great information. I was super impressed with Dr. Mazaa when she was on the program. I think if you have children, if you're thinking about having children down the road and Philadelphia is close enough to you, I think it would be worth it to invest the time to go and check it out. That would be next Saturday, 5 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. If you need more information, you can let me know, and I will see if she either has contact information or if there's a website or anything where you can check to get additional details. With that, we will go ahead and get to the callers. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6. If you would like to participate, you could take 5 minutes to share whatever it is that you would like to discuss. That way we can make sure we include everyone who has dialed in. I'll try to prompt if you have used your 5 minutes. And then if you have additional comments to get in, we'll see if we have extra time before we transition to workplace racism. If we could not use metaphors on the broadcast, that would be great. I ask that just for the compensatory call in. Again, it's been my experience a lot of times when we incorporate metaphors in the way that we speak about racism, white supremacy, counter-racism, a lot of times the things that are being compared are not equivalent, and frequently the metaphors, the analogies, the comparisons, they do not provide clarity, greater understanding about what it is that we are trying to say. If we could just be as explicit as possible, as direct as possible, as simple as possible in what it is that we're trying to express, that would be great. You can use your metaphors any other time, but just the compensatory call in, if we can work to not use metaphors, super appreciated, and I will try to prompt about that as well. Please use your mute button if you know you are in a loud area, or if you think you might, you know, if you have a cough or you might be making some noises or shifting around, if you have your phone or mobile device or however you're participating, if you could use your mute button, that would be extremely appreciated, just to make sure we can preserve the audio quality of the program. Thank you kindly. So like the first five or so people that called in, and I'll just gradually incorporate people as we go. The first five or so people that dialed in with a hand up should be with us if you all have commentary. I think I heard someone.
Okay, this is Devin in Miami.
Greetings.
Greetings, everyone. I just wanted to mention, I don't know if anyone knew about this Arkansas judge, but I was watching CNN throughout the week, and scrolling on the bottom, like they didn't even want to mention it, there was a judge that resigned, and the reason why he resigned is because they had found over 4,600 nude photos of defendants on his computer. And the news had also said at least one of those pictures was of a was of an underage child. So that was an Arkansas judge. I just wanted to mention that. And thanks a lot. I'll mute my line.
Mm-hmm. I saw that posted on my Facebook page as well. I think a lot of, or at least people that I follow, had did seem like a lot of folks were aware of that. I will be curious if they look to do any prosecution for that, or any reevaluation of any of the cases where he was the person that was in charge of the sentencing or conviction or what have you, because I think that certainly is important. I doubt white people will do the correct thing, though. Other folks that we have not heard from, do y'all have commentary?
Have you heard?
Yeah.
Thomas in New York?
Yes, well, am I clear?
Let's see.
Okay, good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers. Great bunch of clips, but I called in specifically to talk about two things, and one of them was what the gentleman just mentioned. And, you know, this judge in Arkansas is in court with 4,600 pictures of nude men in exchange for their sexual favors in taking this nude pictures. They were able to get out of, get less time, reduce sentences, sometimes get off of crimes. Now, I listen to a show that comes on Black Talk Network called New Abolitionist, hosted by Scotty Reed, and it definitely opened my eyes to just the huge disparity in the prison system as far as black inmates as opposed to others. So I would imagine that at least 90% of these photos of these new black men, being that black men are seven times more likely to be incarcerated in the state of Arkansas than white males. These are black people's pictures that are on this white judge's computer, sometimes probably given a deal. You know, you watch The Godfather, you know, you get the offer, you can't refuse. You know, you want 20 years or you want to just bend over, you know. And it's sad, and I hope that they do come up with some charges, some foul charges on this guy. He should go to jail for life, if not get the death penalty for what he's done. A lot of these cases, as far as I know, he was spent a few years on the juvenile circuit. So I would imagine it's more than just one picture of a juvenile offender. And if he has 4,600 pictures, imagine how many people he's done this to over the years, and he didn't take pictures of it. So I wanted to mention that case, and I also wanted to mention what's going on in, seems to be starting in North Carolina, but it's going nationwide, and the president of the United States, the administrative director of white supremacy, Mr. Barack Obama. He is taking away schools, whole state school funding, if they don't have a transgender wrestler or don't conform to the rules. And I was talking to Roz about this, and I was saying, you know, that, let's just say a straight black man wants to dress up like a woman so he could go rape women. He could easily, you know, put on the RuPaul outfit and go to the ladies' room. And, you know, let's just say, you know, they dress up like the woman. They find a white girl in the bathroom and rape them tomorrow. I mean, this whole thing would be over. I mean, it's like, I don't know what's going on. And as I started to think about it, I said, man, maybe this is like a litmus test to just how strong the system is. You know, I can't think of in Ben Tillman's ever, or in Birth of a Nation's ever, where they would have this type of law take place, where black men would have easy access to rape white women, or even if a lesbian decides to go into a men's room full of young black bucks and get raped. I mean, it just pretty much serves as a litmus test so they don't really fear the black man anymore as much as they once did. You know, the fear of genetic annihilation as far as from the black penis is no longer as prevalent as it once was. That's what I'm taking from that, because this law just wouldn't, I can't see this taking place 40 years ago with that huge fear of the black rapist still lingering. So that can't be in their psyche anymore, is what I'm thinking. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, all the callers. I have something really quick to address. First thing I'd like to address is, Gus, which part of Africa was that commentary on about the racism? I don't know if you recall what I'm talking about.
I'm sorry?
Which part of Africa was that commentary on about racism?
South Africa.
Okay, let me just write that down. All right. Next thing I wanted to ask you was that, have you heard of the Rock Newman show?
No.
All right. Well, there's a gentleman on it. I was interviewed by Rock Newman. Rock Newman, he has his own show. It's part of the WHUT, I think it's like the Howard University TV is what it's called. And he interviews numerous people. He's interviewed David Banner, Claude Anderson, and all of that. And before I ask you this one question, have you heard of Craig Steven Wilder?
Yep.
Has he ever come onto the show?
No, sir.
Would you think of, would it be possible if you would be able to, like, to have him on? Or have you ever thought about having, you know, Craig on, or Claude Anderson, or David Banner on the show ever before?
I think all three of them have been asked, and we have not been able to secure those three folks. But all three of them have been invited.
Okay. And my last thing that I want to address is Ronald Moon. I'm not sure if you addressed it on the show before, but I watched it yesterday. It was a video on him, and he was building a community center. I don't know which state. He was building a community center. And he was robbed in his they were vandalizing the home that he was building. It was his father passed away and gave him the home, so he was turning it into a community center because it was in an impoverished neighborhood. It's an impoverished neighborhood, and you know the kid. It's a low income neighborhood, so the kids didn't have anything to do. So they were looking around to go into houses just to hang out, and so that's what they did. They went into his house and they vandalized it, and then. They vandalized it before, and it was one time they vandalized it, and he came in, and he saw them in there, and they beat him up. He said they were between the ages of 14 and 17 years old, and then he made a video and put it on YouTube about he was crying and all of that, and he was just showing his pain about how he felt and how he's trying to help his people, and that it's not I'm trying to use a word other than fair. You know what I mean, though, but it wasn't right for what happened. to him because he's trying to help his people, and he understands their pain, and he was saying that black people's pain is real. That's what it said on the video. So he was interviewed by Rock Newman, and Rock Newman asked him, how come you didn't call the police? And he said something really interesting. He said the reason why he didn't want to call the police is because if he called the police, the police would then be looking for any three black American male and females that fit like any description. Like he was saying they would just bother black people for no reason. He said it was basically him calling the cops on those three people that beat him up inside the home would just give the police officers a reason just to come into his neighborhood and harass the black people. So I think that was kind of racist what he did. I just want to mention that. So if anybody wants to watch the video, it's a Rock Newman show on YouTube, and he interviews people that talk about our condition, and Ronald Moon is one of them, and Craig Steven Wilder is an interesting one as well. And that's it. I mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings, everyone. Greetings, Gus. Very shortly, two subject matters. This week, and Gus, you know about this because I informed you about it. That I discovered, this is for everybody who's listening, I discovered that Tim Wise has a program on Urban View. Don't ask me what time, I'm not familiar on what time, but just for your information, that he has a program. So he would go about the means, in my opinion, of further confusing non-white black people because of the godlike perception that a lot of non-white black people have for a white person that speaks on racism, white supremacy, especially as articulate as Mr. Wise is on the subject. Number two, Delrish Moss. If any of the listeners are not familiar with the name, he is the new police chief of what's the place in St. Louis?
Ferguson?
The police department. Ferguson, yes. He's the police chief of Ferguson, of the Ferguson Police Force in that part of the world. I'm down here in South Florida, been here, for a very long time. I don't really know him personally, but I'm pretty sure I've been around him, just like a lot of areas where non-white people at. If you're the spokesman of some sort of big corporation, such as law enforcement of a large city, you're always on television. You're gonna be pretty popular in the quote unquote non-white black community. Or should I say, area where non-white people are allowed to stay, you're going to be quite popular. And he was, because just about every news day he was going to be on television. Always impressed with being sort of, articulate and whatnot, that sort of thing. But nevertheless, to want to be on get into a job of that nature. The only thing I say is I pray that nothing really happens to him as far as even from the most serious point to anything else that can go wrong. A lot of things possibly could. I'm pretty sure he was qualified for a lot more positions, or even chief of police of a lot of more places that wouldn't be so much high profile in that way. But, for whatever reasons, somebody has to take the job. So hopefully he would do well and improve law enforcement from that standpoint. in Ferguson, Missouri. Although there have been some questions about his sexuality, I would say that unfortunately may also come up in Ferguson, which would complicate whatever constructive ambitions that he has with that profession. And that's all I have to say for right now. Thank you.
Other folks that we have not.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, hey. Good evening. Good evening. Like yourself, I too was just totally upset on how Brian Lehrer just dismissed that caller. You know, and, you know, like you said, as if he didn't have a valid point, and, you know, I can't believe, you know, anyone would say such a thing like that. And I also understood how he mentioned how these kinds of things are just revenue generators. You know, and also, Dan Baum, I remember he played the interview, and he made a point of saying how eventually people will come around to telling the truth, you know, given enough time. Now, when did he interview Ehrlichman? Did he state when he interviewed Ehrlichman?
1994.
Okay, and he published this article when?
April of this year.
Okay, so for 22 years, Mr. Baum committed a serious act of racism. Now, if he was so concerned, and this is another reason why I don't deal with the whole liberal conservative thing. Now, okay, he knew that the Nixon administration created this war on drugs to get black people in prison. Now, instead of him pulling this out in 1994, he waits 22 years. Now, could you imagine how many lives could have been saved in the cases of a class action lawsuit or knowing that people were targeted? How they could have had these cases dismissed. But yet, he chose to continue the racism by putting other black, he chose to continue the racism by allowing this information to be hidden. That's all I have to say.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I just wanted to comment on the gentleman who had the Black First organization. I thought that he showed great black self-respect when he said that he didn't want whites in the organization, that the only thing that white people could do would be to give back what was stolen from us. and thank you for taking my call.
For sure, for sure. All the folks that we have not heard from, if y'all had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys. Greetings to all the callers and the listeners. I just wanted to speak on a couple of the clips. I think this was the first clip you played in regards to the feelings that some Caribbean Africans have, that they have a superior culture to African Americans and things of that nature. It's very interesting because that was not my experience. My parents came here from the Caribbean, specifically Trinidad and Tobago, in about 71, and they told me many stories of listening to racial events unfolding in the United States over the radio in Trinidad. So when they came here, they had a different consciousness of the American African experience. So when I was coming up, I was brought up essentially to understand that it was those African American ancestors that paved the way for my parents to be able to come here and to get their start. And actually my father specifically was the one who really immersed himself in African centered liberation behavior when he got here. And it was his experiences here that led to that. So I was always brought up to respect African Americans in a way that I know that some African Caribbeans do not. I've heard those stories before, and I've also heard the reverse from Caribbeans, African Caribbeans, in regards to how they were treated by American Africans. But it was just very interesting, that clip, because it is something that I find to be very sick, in my opinion. I remember Dr. Ben addressing that as well back in the 80s, talking about how there was a big rift between Caribbean Africans when he first came here in the 30s and American Africans, and that over time there was, of course, amalgamation through people getting married and falling in love with each other and things of that nature. And he talked about that as well as the cultural shift with calypso music and reggae music coming here and getting a foothold on these things, and other events that led to a cultural amalgamation. Also the fact that Kwame Ture came here from Trinidad as well, and also got involved in with the Black Panthers and other African liberation movements when he was here. So he discussed a lot of that before, so this is not new. It's just very interesting, that clip, because it's something that, like I said, my experience was very much the opposite, but I do know that it does exist. The other thing I wanted to touch on was the clip with about Andrew Loco and the fact that there was video footage of, I don't know if it's the full event or if it was afterwards, after the event was done, how they treated him or mistreated him. I'll just say this. I believe that because we have been conditioned to accept Black death on camera now in a way in which it's become like an everyday event, I don't think anything is going to happen, even with the footage. I don't think it's going to change anything. I think the police officers are going to get away with it, and at most they'll probably just get a new job in another precinct someplace else. That's just our current and historical treatment in the system of racism, white supremacy. And then I thought the clip about the sexual terrorism of the Black family towards the end was just disgusting, and it just proves to me that white people will use anything, including sexual activity, to racially terrorize Black people. This also, to me, is proof positive, again, that white people, they get sexual satisfaction from terrorizing and killing Black people. There is some sort of orgasmic experience they get from combining the two, because I just think it's in their DNA to be racist. I don't care what age they are. I don't care if they're a non-speaking baby or if they're an elderly, half-retarded 80-year-old. They're all racist white supremacists, and I just find this a telling example that they would go so hard on a family with a terminally ill father and a fighting for her survival, a young Black female with cancer, and they would terrorize her through the walls for 2 years. And I know that that would never have been tolerated had the reverse been true and it was a white family supposedly being terrorized by a Black family.
And lastly, the last thing was that the brother that was speaking not too long ago who talked about the guy who was assaulted in his own house and refused to go to the police to deal with it because he wanted to prevent any mistreatment of black people kind of reminds me of a story of a couple of times I've heard this about Dr. Ben. There was a mentally ill homeless man in Harlem that had assaulted him severely and put him in the hospital, and this has happened more than once. And he never went to the police. He spent months in the hospital recovering, things like that, but he never went to the police to turn in this mentally ill black male. And he was asked at one point, why didn't he pursue that route? And he actually said, and this was something that kind of changed my life when it comes to black self-respect, he said, I would never go to my slave master to mediate a disagreement between me and another African anywhere in the world. He said, that's just something I refuse to do. And he kind of basically left it at that. But the response from the crowd was so immense. And for me, it just shifted my consciousness as far as black self-respect and understanding that he was able to understand that this man was mentally ill. And rather than put this man in further terrorism because he's suffering in the street as it is, that he would not pursue anything with white people to go attack another black person. And I just wanted to put that out there. And thank you for taking my call, guys. I definitely have something for workplace racism as well.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hello to you, Gus, and to all the callers and listeners. To the guy that talked about the young man who was trying to build that house, trying to turn that house into a community center, that was somewhere in Ohio. I think it's something like down by the Cincinnati area or something like that. So I remember seeing that. Some of the details he gave, I didn't know, and I just know it was really sad because they did. They jumped on him, and he did have a video on YouTube. I saw it on Facebook where he was crying, and he was just talking about how sad it was. You know, he was trying to do something for the community, but, you know, what was going on. So that is somewhere here in Ohio. Anyway, just a couple of things. The first clip about, you know, the differences, between Jamaica and African Americans, and all I can just think as I listen to that is this, and I like what he said, it's global. You know, he just basically like, you know, this is a global issue with black people. And I, you know, listened and I said, wow, I said, it's global, and yet we still just can't connect the dots as a people to overcome this. So that's the only thing I can think of. As far as the South African story, I really did like when a man, you know, he told the white guy, you know, go among your own people and do, you know, and, you know, and because I always just think here in this country, whenever black people try to do something, here come white people who want to get involved. And unfortunately, in too many cases here, which it may be the same in South Africa, but I know for me, in too many cases here, we will gladly embrace them. Yeah, bring them on in, bring them on in. And so I just thought that was very interesting when he said that. Thank you for your comment on the case about the man that just dismissed the guy. Because I remember I was listening to him. I said, did you just dismiss that guy? Like, you know, Ehrlichman didn't say that. And what does this have to do with that? I'm just like, so when you say that, so thank you for that. Because I just thought, hey, I just thought maybe I was hearing things. But, I mean, he just basically dismissed that young man out of hand. Just so, yeah, I mean, basically he just called the guy, you're lying. That's just not true. What does that lie have to do with this, you know? So I thought that was something. I have no words about the. Well, I guess I may do have some words about the sex thing. It just to me, it just shows the mentality of these people, and I just think the quicker we learn and realize the mentality of these people, that we then will begin to act different, and I mean we'll begin to change the way we act to help us to be able to overcome them. Because, I mean, it's just no excuse. Listen to that story. I mean, that to me sounds like something you would read in a novel. But, you know, this is an actual story going on. I think the thing that kind of got me, though, because I don't know if that was, the Young Turks or whoever was reporting that, but it's something about when I hear these white people, and it's just like, oh, you know, this is so bad for the family, and you know, it's just like they seem to be so concerned when it's just like all you doing is you just making money. You putting the story out there you're on TV, somebody's paying you a salary, and you're making money. And so you might, my thing is just tell the story. Don't try to convince me that, oh, my God, I'm just so upset. Oh, why would they do this? And, oh, my God, you know, the girl has cancer, and his dad has cancer, which is sad. Don't get me wrong. But it's just something about their attitudes. I see these people take, I was looking at a video on Facebook today, and it was this guy films this man beating this woman in the street. I guess this actually happened recently. This is in Philadelphia. And all they showed these people, everybody standing around watching this, nobody tried to stop it or anything. And so it wasn't a news story until, what did they say, somebody posted it, and I guess somebody at the news station saw it, and they managed to, they called the police to find out about it, and then they managed to find the guy who filmed it, and they talked to the guy, and he just said he didn't want to face those cameras. And, you know, it was just like how, everybody just stood around and watched this man beat this woman. And then they brought on this psychiatrist. And all of the news anchors were white. It was two white women, and maybe one of those women looked like she may have had some Asian in her. And it was a white male. And they just seemed like, oh, we're just so concerned. Oh, my God, this is so sad. And they called in a psychiatrist or psychologist, you know, to talk about what they thought. But, I mean, it was like a 14-minute video, and I was just like, oh, okay. But, I get the story, but I guess for me, stop seeming like you really care. This is just a business, and you're making money off of telling these stories. And today, lately, these black stories, like you say, black deaths, black beatings, black folks killing their children, stuff like that, that is really what's keeping local news, if you will, going. As far as the judge, I did hear about the story. I guess he's supposed to be banned for life for, being a judge. But it is something, all these photos, all these pictures, and it's just like, well, he's banned for life. And it's almost kind of like, well, let's close the story. We've taken care of it. You know, and it's just like, actually, you haven't. As far as Brooklyn, you have, in my opinion, a bunch of incompetents who are running this court system. Always have been, in my opinion, incompetent. But when you had, you know, this mass push to arrest people and put them in the system. So now the numbers of people, how do I want to say, the weight of the numbers of people that's being pushed in there has really brought the court system in Brooklyn to a stop. Because the situation with the young man who sat in jail for 3 years on a untruth and then gets out and commits suicide, it never should have happened. But it did, unfortunately. Here's my last thing, and this is a question for you, Gus. Well, thank you for the shows that you had this past week, Dr. Tommy Curry. It was a really good program. And Joseph Gibson. And what I would like to know is, what is your opinion on Joseph Gibson, what he presented on your show the other night? And I'll mute myself to hear your answer. And thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. I could give codified, right? He said what he said. But since he wrote a book, and people would comment on the book, the general premise in terms of racism damaging the brain of black people, I think that's accurate. That's something I think people had posited before. I think 909 and several other guests, I think we had, there have been several studies before. They were not addressing racism, but they were just talking about when you are in impoverished conditions and you lack resources and what have you, that damages your ability to process information, to think clearly, where they had done lots of studies on this. So I completely agree with that. The thing that I just had a problem with was the terminology that was used in the presentation of the book. That was like when I told him the term white privilege and microaggression and black people are racist, like those, the way that he articulates racism, white supremacy, there are many things that, you know, I just, in my view, they're not accurate. I would not articulate it that way, but I mean, hey, he's a victim of racism, so he said what he said. That's his assessment of racism. Those particular things I don't agree with. And I think he even brought up that this would, I guess, be two programs in a row where, in his book at least, he suggests that white people are not aware or are unconscious or are unwittingly somehow practicing racism. And I certainly vehemently disagree with that, but I mean, that's a very common position that a lot of people take in the book. Again, he does say in the most recent book that we discussed that he does think that white people, generally speaking, are aware of this, but that's very, very much later in the book. And I told him that when he was on the program, that's very much later in the in the book. You have to read a lot about implicit bias and, you know, unconsciously and blah, 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 and all this other stuff before you get to that. So a lot of that stuff I said on the program in terms of things that I just are different from my assessment of racism. But the main thesis of the book, that racism damages the brain of black people, I think is extremely accurate. And that's why I was glad that we were able to have him on the program, because the main point I think is important, something that people should think about. And I think is how would I say? I think that is every bit as important as the other points that I may not agree with.
Okay. Now, just a couple of things, and then I'm
kind of did your 5 minutes, okay. So if we have time, we'll ring back and get the rest. Anybody?
Okay. All right.
For sure. Anybody that we have not heard from? Anybody that we haven't heard from? Want to make sure they get their commentary in? Oh, did we get everybody? If we got everybody, that's fantastic. Then folks will have time to get their extra stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, really quick. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I just wanted to point out a few things. I think it was a clip where it was a guy that was trying to get a parking spot, and he used a derogatory term, or a nigger, to a non-white person, and she just said, "But I'm not even black." And then he was like, "Hey, you know, I don't even care. You're still this and that." It reminded me of a video that I seen on YouTube. It was sort of the same, but it was a black female, but it was on a white woman's YouTube page, and it was a black female in a dispute with a white man, and she was talking to the police, saying that he approached her and confronted her about using a handicap spot. And then she was like, "Well, who are you? Are you the police?" And then the guy actually lied and said, "Yes, I am." But he was not. So that was very interesting on that incident. And he told her to go back to Africa in the usual cliche insults. And there was it's a school, I think, up in Jacksonville, down in Florida, where there's been like a whole bunch of violence and fights at this middle school. I think it's called Ocean Way Middle School. And like the violence began so bad, well, they was calling it like racial tension or whatnot. And now these are like 13-year-olds. They said on the video article clips that the students actually started wearing black shirts and white shirts to support each side. And one of the parents was on the clip saying that this was a white parent, said that her child was told that she couldn't wear a black shirt because she may be supporting a certain side. Like, they didn't say clearly what it meant, but they showed one of the fights on one of the clips, and apparently it was a white kid being beat up by a black kid because he used the word nigger, and you know, not the N-word, but they said the N-word. But yeah, it's been a whole bunch of violence at that school, so I thought that was very interesting that they had to, they ended up wearing white shirts and black shirts to school. Like, this middle school kids. And that's all I had.
Andrew Jackson is rolling over in his grave. Sorry, that's a metaphor. I shouldn't say that. But, wow, that is amazing. Amazing. I thought the young white people were getting better about all this. They had voted for President Obama or hoped that they could. And we were almost done with this whole problem. Did we miss anybody? Anybody who has not spoken at all? we get everybody? Anybody who has a hand up should be with us. We get everybody? I guess some people could be waiting for workplace racism. All right. I will assume that we got everybody. And if folks who have a hand up and have not shared that they are waiting for workplace racism, which we will be transitioning in a little bit more than 10 minutes. Do not wait until the last minute. If you do have something you want to share that is not related to workplace racism, you should get your hand up like right now if you have something else that you would like to discuss. The caller in Ohio, I guess we should have time if other folks want to get anything else. Caller in Ohio, did you have anything else you wanted to share?
Okay. Yeah, just a couple of things to follow up on the question I asked you. Thank you for your assessment. I just wonder because I know he, you know, the time he went and then you went off the air. Just a couple of things. I do agree with that about, you know, that we have our brains, we have been affected. And I think the other thing is, too, so have they. I mean, you know, we know it's not a vacuum. But I the other thing I agree, too, I asked him about, because remember, around the room, but I asked him, because I'm like, how does this black racism manifests itself, and one of the big problems I was having, because I was saying that it's something about this, you're saying blacks being racist. I said, because I know today, you know, that's what white people want to say, not only white people, every other non-black, non-white people, even some black people, you know, want to say that blacks are racist. And the thing being is, if you say, you know, when they say blacks are racist, this, that, we talk about racism. We talk about the things, you know, we talk about history, and then, like I say, I'll be one of the biggest racists, you know, if that's the case, because I'm going to forever want to bring up what has happened to black people. So I'm having a problem with that word, too, that you're saying that blacks are racist. So I'm like you, I think that he needs to find other terminology, you know. The other thing, and I just want to say this, and this should be my last comment, he started off by saying, I can't think of a word he said, but he was saying that he felt there are good white people. I'm paraphrasing them. Those weren't his words. And he said he had saw white people working with young black people or what have you. And as I thought about it, because unfortunately when that night the show was on, I just forgot that. I mean, I could not remember that. And I just feel like, and I know this is a deep statement here, racist. I just feel that all whites are racist. I didn't feel like that, but as I've grown, I feel that all of them are racist, maybe varying degrees, but they all are. And I think what he was saying about he's seen white work with black people, you know, and black youth and stuff, I just feel that's a part of their racism. And I just feel that that's done to keep confusion among black people. And so I thought, like I said, I do agree with the assessment that we have been affected by what has happened to us. And so, I just wanted to say that. I just want to do that follow-up. Anyway, thank you. I'll mute myself. Thank you very much.
For sure. And so I think he explained on the program, when he says that black people are racist, that he means in terms of anti-blackness. In terms of how we treat other black people, and we unfortunately have been contaminated with a lot of the racist concepts, anti-black concepts, in how we think about and treat other black people. I'm just of the opinion that, you know, I view white supremacy as a crime. There's no other crime I can think of where we use the same term to label the perpetrators and the victims. I just feel like there needs to be a better term, because it's already very popular to suggest that everybody is racist. Everybody practices racism. Even if you differentiate how you explain or qualify that, it's still just leaning towards the momentum that's already there, that it's not just white people, everybody's racist. And nothing could be further from the truth. I just think that it would be more helpful. It would minimize confusion if we're not using the same term to brand the perpetrators, the people who are practicing terrorizing black people, to then come and label the victims with that same term. To me, that just seems inaccurate. But that's my view. I could be in error. That is ubiquitous in the system of white supremacy. Might even be a part of the brain damage, thinking that there are some good white people, some whites that are not racist. I think even that has come up in medical apartheid, Harriet Washington, where that seems to be mentioned, that, hey, this white person is doing some good things for black people, so this white person or this small contingent of whites cannot be racist because they did something. I think Benjamin Rush specifically, where she was saying that he was a quote-unquote abolitionist, so it wouldn't be accurate to label him a racist. And myself, and I think one of our previous guests, Vernelia Randall, she clearly did not agree with that assessment, that it's very easy for racists to, when it's convenient, when it suits their purpose, to give the appearance that they're looking out for the coloreds when their overall objective is still permanent domination of dark people forever. Anybody else have anything else they want to get in before we get to workplace racism?
Can I be heard? Go ahead, Thomas. I'll go after you.
Yes, be real quick. You know, I was just listening to what you said, and I agree. You know, today, me and my wife, we watched the NWA movie, Straight Outta Compton, for the first time. And man, oh man, that was such like a sad story, man, because those doggone Jews in the music industry just ruined, you know, those brothers' friendship. And I mean, I've seen it play out over and over again. And they have so much power. So it was a point in the movie where Ice Cube made a diss song about N.W.A. and he called the word Jew to describe the white guy who came in between them. And he, you know, oh my God, I want to call the Anti-Defamation League and we're going to get our lawyers on him. And it's like, man, you're managing a group called niggers with an attitude. Like, I mean, just the filth of these people. So I believe it's in Brooklyn. There's a school bus parked outside of a synagogue. A group of black teens, they cut this, catch this bus on fire. They don't put a swastika or any derogatory words on the bus. You know, it looked like just a bunch of kids playing around, you know, with fire. They got in there. They realized it got way too big. They had to run out the bus, and you see them on the tape running. But they're charging all these kids with hate crimes because it happened in front of a synagogue. And you know, just the power of those people, just, you know, just very strong. And I'll mute my line. That's all I wanted to say.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to chime in and say I completely agree with you. Everything that you pointed out in the discussion is exactly what I pointed out. Thomas and I were talking about that as well. I just believe that Neely Fuller has the most accurate terms because he was describing anti-blackness but using the term black racist. And I was telling Thomas, I said, some of his language is very convoluted, and it would be confusing to people who may not have a higher awareness of the way the system functions, whereas because he and I kind of have more of an understanding of it, we could see through the terms he was using and the inaccuracy of those terms. So it just speaks to the importance of the power of words and what we use, what we say. And also the other thing was when you were talking, I played the clip about Khalif Browder, it made me think of an incident that happened to me in the Bronx. And when I was living there, I was coming home from night school, and I would get off the train a little bit after 11 every evening. And I was coming home from night school, and as I was coming to the lower platform, because it's an elevated train, to the lower platform before you take, there's like two or three staircases you take down to the street level. So when I get to the main area where the toll booth clerk was, three police jump out of this hidden area, and they stopped me. And I asked them, well, you know, what am I being stopped for? And they said, well, we have reason to believe you were trafficking drugs from the Bronx to Brooklyn. I said, well, what are you talking about? I said, I go to night school. I'm just coming home from school right now. So they took my bag. They went through my bag. They dumped everything out. All of my notes and stuff from weeks worth of schoolwork went blowing everywhere because trains were coming in and out of the train station. So all my stuff just blew everywhere. And then they just left me there to clean up everything. And I couldn't get all of my work. So there was a black male token booth clerk there, and I said, I hope that you see what's going on here, because I said they had no reason to stop me, but I just wanted to, you know, just let him. And I was talking to him while the police were stopping me, and you could see on his face that he was, like, really uncomfortable with what he saw them doing to me, but he couldn't do anything about it. So I said to him, I said, I hope you're looking at this, because I haven't done anything. And then, you know, the police didn't really do anything else. I think they just got the power of the liberty of tearing my stuff up like they did. They ripped the lining out of my book bag and all kind of stuff. And when I was listening to the clip about them saying just how horrible the disparities are as far as how long they keep people in jail without any sort of due process, it just made me think I was lucky that night because they could have put drugs in the bag and said that I was trafficking something and I would have been in a situation similar to Khalif Browder. So it was just something that it brought to memory. Thank you for taking my call.
Before we have a minute or two left, so I guess if there's like one or two people, if they have a concise comment they want to get in before we transition to workplace racism, a suggestion that I would give out with regards to what happened with the victims of racism in the group NWA and what happened with them, I would focus on these individuals likely practicing white supremacy as opposed to it being about them being quote-unquote Jews or Jewish or anything of that nature, just because if I say that these Jews did something, there are a sizable population of non-white people who are Jews. We've had some as guests on the program, and when they were here, they were reporting that they, too, were victims of white supremacy. I'm of the opinion that you have a whole lot of white people who are claiming that they are affiliated with many different quote-unquote religions, be it Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Baha'i, anything. At the end of the day, the religion that they're really practicing is white supremacy. And what it sounds like, I saw straight out of Compton as well, what it sounded like, what it looked like, I'm familiar with that, how that played out in real life. This is just a race soldier practicing white supremacy. That's what it sounds like to me. That's my interpretation of it. That, I think, might be the most accurate way to go, because I think whites are very good at diverting the conversation, and they might even come back and say that you are being an anti-Semite or a host of other things. You might end up being the racist by, you know, the time that they get done with everything. That would be the way that I would go about addressing that, but that's my view. Anybody have anything they want to get in before we get to workplace racism?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just wanted to make sure. I think that Mr. Fuller was very precise and accurate when he made the statement that any white person that is capable of practicing racism probably is practicing racism, white supremacy. And the way he explained it, he mentioned, you know, from the way I understand it, I go from the early stages. When that white child is able to recognize in their perception that the white doll is the pretty doll, then they're capable of practicing racism, white supremacy. When that white child is able to perceive that the white doll is better or prettier or whatever, that sort of thing, that is at the earlier stage. He also gave an example of the white person who may have got hit by a car, maybe got shot in the head or something like that. They're still alive. But now that's a white person at that point in time is not capable of practicing racism now because they're in a state. The only thing they can do maybe is blink an eye or something like that. But maybe before they got hit by that car, they are very much on the suspect list. So that's kind of like really making it a sharp and clear as possible can be. That just tells you it's a lot of white people who are not admitting it, but yet they are practicing racism, white supremacy on a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week basis. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Right on. That will take us to workplace racism. We had quite a few people who wrote in commentaries this week, so I'll try to get through those quickly. People would like to participate in workplace racism. The number again is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Okay. Different people wrote in workplace racism. Report number one, if you will remember the audio clip about the worker in San Francisco. He worked for the bus system there, so this would be a city employee who's making the racist comments, terrorizing a likely non-white person because he, you know, you took my parking place, so I'm going to terrorize you. I'm upset. So this person wrote in, Bay Area listener. He says, I never have the courage to speak up during the workplace racism segment. However, I have you and your show to thank for me becoming more aware about racism and what it is. I work for the BART in the Bay Area. The BART is the Bay Area Rapid Transit. It's like the train subway system there. Oscar Grant died there. I clean the stations. Doing this kind of work, I get to really see white people for what they truly are. Hateful, disrespectful actors, and just evil, among other things. I've been called all types of nigger. I've been threatened with violence several times by whites. I'm not big, not so tall, 5'8". My hair is locked, muscular, with a lot of melanin. While at work, I never get this behavior when I am not at work. While at work, I've been harassed by vendors that work in the different stations. Every time I make a report, the BART police get mad at me. I requested a citizen's arrest before. The white BART officer who took my statement one time told me they can put whatever they want on the paper, and that's what would be believed. I've had them get angry, and they get hostile towards me for asking a question. Remember, I'm the victim in these cases. Now, saying all this, last Saturday, May 7th, 2016, one of the white homeless people told me several times he was going to kill me while calling me all kinds of niggers. He had a weapon in his hand and took an attacking stance. I let the police know because lately there has been a lot of violence towards BART employees. So after barely looking for, excuse me, so, So after barely looking for him, the white officer comes to me and tells me not to engage him. I say I didn't engage him, the homeless person, in the first place. Needless to say, that pissed him off. So they leave, and here comes the homeless guy once again, threatening me and calling me a nigger again. I was so mad and embarrassed. Later, I see the guy, and I see the same officer. I point him out as the cop walks up on me, pissed off. I asked him, is it okay for the guy to threaten my life? He says, I didn't say that. I tell him, there he goes. The officer was so super focused on me. I don't know what to do. This is not the first time. He's seeking any suggestions or input. I did write back a few suggestions or what have you. I'll maybe share later. All right, so this is, that's one. Second report. Workplace racism. Different person. This week, the director of the security department, white guy, walked into the employee cafeteria and said to a security guard, black guy, what's up, my nigger? Another employee overheard and reported it under the third party offended, report or what have you. I've never even heard of that. And the director was fired. Number two, this happened some years ago, but stays in my head. A white female would always speak and be extra friendly. I would speak just enough not to be rude. Wasn't codified back then, just didn't trust white people. I have a light complexion and darkness during the summer. So one summer day, she says, oh, your tan is so nice. I would love to be your color. I responded, you may not mind being my complexion, but I don't think you want to be my color. The look on her face was priceless, and she gave no response. Last incident of workplace racism. Unfortunately, I witnessed an obese, dangerous white woman go to a black female's desk when she knew she wasn't there and looked at the things she had on her computer screen. Chats, open programs, etc. Always lock your computer, even if only stepping away a few feet or only for a few moments. I suspect white people are always watching and studying our behavior. Don't leave any information or bring anything personal or non-work related to work. great suggestions. I think that's 2 weeks in a row that this has came up, and having suspected race soldiers snooping around your work area. So those are the three that people wrote in. People have comments or suggestions dealing with those three. That is fine. If you have your own incidents of workplace racism you would like to share, feel free.
Well, you know what's crazy is in New York, they have a law. It's on every bus when you get on it, and any assault of a bus driver is like assaulting a police officer. Like it's grade A felony. You know, you're going to jail. And, there's no doubt about it. So I'm shocked that they you know, and they enforce it very well here. I've seen black bus drivers call on a white person assaulting them, and that the cops come and scoop them right up. I'm just shocked that they allow that to happen in such a huge organization. I know it has to have a lot of black employees in BART. I think it's the second largest transit company in the United States behind New York. So, wow. This doesn't surprise me.
And FYI, I used to live in the Bay Area, so I'm somewhat knowledgeable about this area. This is not unusual. They had a major report within the last, like, 18 months where apparently this was a standard thing, BART employees being threatened. And I mean, where this got, like, reported, this was in, like, the news and what have you, where they were leaving nooses on their workstations, referring to them as niggers. It seemed like some of this was not coming from, like, transit users or some random, you know, transient or what have you. Seemed like some of this might have been coming from their white BART coworkers, but nothing, same thing, nothing was being done about this, and it seemed like it was widespread. This is not an isolated event. It seems like this has been a problem for a long time. That's why I said keep in mind the audio segment from this week, even though that was not a BART employee, that was he was a San Francisco transit worker with the bus station in San Francisco. That's not BART, but I mean, it's right there and it's the same place. So this is not an isolated event within BART, San Francisco, even system of white supremacy at large. But I told him that I would include that when I go to make my report to the BART police agency, and when you go to report it to the people that you work for at BART, that there seems to be a pattern of unsafe work conditions and abuse of black BART employees. And I would pull out those news reports over the last year or so documenting that this seems to be widespread. And what are we doing to solve this problem?
I remember those reports. And did you have a guest on who talked about workplace racism? And he was working in, I believe, the Bay Area and the sanitation department.
Yes, sir. Daryl Muhammad, two-time guest.
Also with a noose involved, right? Went down the conveyor belt?
Correct.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, everyone, I guess, and the callers. I'm giving you an update on my two-year project. I thought after the Ferguson thing, before the Ferguson thing, that we're such a small place that surely we should be able to at least have some say as black people in our local electoral, you know, politics. So the first thing I did was clean up the elections office for the county. We got somebody in there who, you know, white guy who didn't know anybody. And now it's at, you know, they brought him up to the commission a couple of times. So now the elections are coming up in November. So he's got the DA, the sheriff, the judge, and they've got this guy that they've asked to hire somebody because you know, they owed a person favor and he refused. And so now the police are following him everywhere he goes, and people are putting requests on him to dig up 20 years worth of elections, and his health is suffering, and he's freaking out, and I don't know, we may not be able to hang on to him until this next election, but that was the first thing I did. That took a year, just a year, just to clean up that one electoral office. And so everybody's starting to participate, you know, encourage everybody to participate. And I'm noticing that we whatever white people tell us, we just believe it. We just believe it right away. So we've got these black people who are out there, and we're encouraging them to run for office. And the white people aren't campaigning. They aren't spending any money on signs. They aren't going anywhere. And the white, the black people are telling each other, well, you know, white people don't campaign like we campaign. And I said, who told you that? They said, it's true, they don't. I said, well, you need to call Hillary Clinton, because she's campaigning her behind off. And so is Bernie Sanders, and so is Donald Trump. So whoever told you that, they're lying to you so that you won't suspect that something unusual is going on. So then 2 days into an 8-day election, the mayor comes out and says, the election's over with. Mathematically speaking, the white lady has it. And he tells all the candidates that. And they go, well, the mayor ought to know. It's over with already. And I'm going, mathematically speaking, 2 days into an election, isn't that kind of strange? So, you know, we are so gullible, because this is an office I have not audited. The one I spent a year auditing, and this is one I haven't. But the elections, it's who counts the votes. Every election it's who counts the votes. These elections are so crooked. It's just like Dr. Umar Johnson was saying, hey, you weren't there when they were scoring your kids' star test. So I just can't believe how crooked these elections are. I mean, there's just nothing honest going on. Oh, and a pipe burst. All the electrical, all the elections equipment, it drowned. It has to be done again. It has to be rechecked. So I'm sure when there's a glitch in it for this next election in November, they'll say, oh, well, you know, who knows? We should have known something was going to happen. We should. I'm like, I want to say it's hopeless, but I don't tend to be a hopeless type of person, but this is really astounding. I mean, I don't know if I'm communicating this to you, but, and the police follow me. They follow me now. So, I mean, I was on the jogging path a couple of days ago, and the jogging path, and I hear bloop, bloop like that, and there's an SUV behind me. I'm like, what are you doing? He says, oh, have you seen any suspicious black men in the park? I'm like, just you. You're the only one. You have an SUV on the jogging path. So it's getting out of control, because the sheriff and the DA and the judge, they're panicking because no one's caving. They're sending out bribe after bribe, and no one's biting. So it's really escalating now. I just thought I'd share that with you guys.
Hey, can I just say something about that, Gus, real quick? You know, I've been listening to the show for years, and I've been listening to Karma talk about, I believe that's Karma, talk about the working in this political process where she lives at. And, I mean, she's just, like so solidified my stance on not voting over the years. And this show, I mean, what she just said today, like, you know, the count the votes, it's pointless. I mean, I just don't get it. And I'm glad she's come on over the years and shared these stories, because it's just like, him at home, don't, you know.
The two new people that joined the line, did you all have commentary, workplace racism, either what you have heard from folks already, or if you had your own incidents you wanted to share, either or is acceptable.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So on my team right now, I don't know if you guys know, like, I sell cars, so anyway, I'll get into it. But on my team right now is two white ladies. So there's like an older, like skinny white lady, and there's like a fat white girl. Anyway, so we were outside standing, like, so when you don't have customers, you pretty much just, sometimes you just like stand outside and do nothing pretty much. So I just happened to be standing outside, and like I guess a customer had came on, and they were like, oh, do you want that customer or whatever? Because we have a list of order that we're doing. So anyway, she was saying, somehow it came up like, oh, like something about running to customers. Like, I don't know what. I don't even know how we got on that topic. But anyway, the white lady was like, yeah, I'm going to refer to myself as Jay. So anyway, she was like, yeah, like we all know if we have to run to the customers, freaking Jay will win. And then I think she caught herself. And, like, so I'm like 6'3". So she caught herself and she was like, yeah, because he's the tallest. But anyway, I got another story too. So this happened a while back. I would say in like December. So anyway, one of the managers had owed me a deal. So this was at night. So it had to be like it was super dark. It had to be at like 9 p.m. So what happened was that so he came to me. He was like, hey, Justin, go grab a check-in slip. So you grab a check-in slip, like when you check in the car, like, so they verify it, like they put all the information in or whatever. So anyway, I grab a check-in slip on the car, and then from there, he introduced me to the guy. So sometimes, like, you know, they just get people deals, so you don't even know, like, the customer or whatever. So anyway, he introduced me to the guy, and he made me sign, fill out a credit app with him. So I'm filling out the credit app with the guy. Now, the guy looks like he's like a freaking – like a scumbag looking white dude, like with a bunch of tattoos or whatever. And it was kind of weird that he gave me the deal at the time, because a lot of this stuff was weird. Like he didn't have a credit app already, and just a bunch of stuff. So anyway, I'm doing the credit app with the guy. He has, like, mind you, has a bunch of tattoos, like messed up teeth. He has like a freaking a new era fitted cap on, whatever. And I asked him, like, oh, what's your occupation? He's like, oh, well, I work in Catalina Island, like, as a chef. And I'm like, really? Like, you work as a chef? But I'm like, dude, like, you know, he's a white dude. Like, people get hired anywhere. So whatever. Anyway, so I fill it out. I go to my manager. I'm like, it's a done deal, whatever. Let me go put this in our CRM. That's where we put the information. So, you know, it'd be accurate or whatever. So he was like, no, you don't have to put it in. He was like, here, give me a credit app. So I'm like, this is kind of suspicious, because they never help you do anything. Like, even if they give you a deal, they really don't help you do anything. So while I'm talking to the manager, I noticed my guy had walked out. My guy had walked out the dealership. And then I look, like, I turn around, and he's freaking getting arrested. I'm like, what the hell is going on? So anyway, I find out that this white dude had called, and he was actually using someone else's identity, and they had got him down there to basically like a sting operation, and they freaking tricked me into being the damn the guy to work with him. I was like, man, and I actually quit after this, but I had came back. But yeah, it was terrible. But yeah, that's all I had.
Did you get the impression that your white colleagues, that they knew that this was a sting operation, that, you know, this was about to go down, or did they find out at the same time you did?
No, I was the only one who didn't know. So it was like, and I was suspicious. So like I said, like when he asked me, like, oh yeah, just give me the credit app. I was like, they never helped me. They never help you put anything in. They literally never help you with any of, like, the putting the paperwork in and stuff. They always like, oh, man, go do it, like, you know, whatever. So I'm like, this kind of weird. But at the same time, I'm like, damn, like, he owes me a deal, so why wouldn't it be this easy? So, but I find out everyone knew.
Wow. Gus, can I speak to that briefly? Hello?
Oh, yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Okay, thank you. It's funny that what he just talked about just reminded me of something. There's a book that I'm reading called 5 Secrets That Can Save Your Life, and it's basically an ex-CIA agent talking about the things that he's done in the field to protect himself from harm, and that he teaches average citizens and stuff. And one thing he talks about is situational awareness and being aware of normalcy. And what the guy just was talking about was normalcy. The fact that, like you said, normally they wouldn't help me with a sale at all. They'll leave you on your own. But in that moment, all of a sudden, they're being helpful. So that was something that was abnormal that he caught wind of. And then after the fact, he finds out that he's basically you know, they're working this game on him, and he's the only one who's not aware. So, again, it just speaks to white people and their ability to band together in secret to do things where we're not consciously aware that we're being manipulated in some way. And kudos to you just for your ability to peep out the normalcy and the abnormal behavior in that situation, heightened your awareness, even though you didn't fully understand everything until after the fact. You functioned really well. So I just wanted to speak about that. Thank you.
Did you ask them why they didn't, you know, share the information so that you too would know that, you know, hey, this guy, there's a sting operation that's about to go down?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess they didn't, so they didn't know the guy was going to come down. So the guy came down, and I guess it was like a quit, like this, you know, this is what they told me. It was like, he was like, oh, man, yeah, I didn't have anybody else, like, man, get out of here. So they, I mean, and he could have told me, but he was like, you would be acting nervous if I told you. So I was like, man, you could have told me that, and I would have freaking not took it. And that's why he was like, oh, man, yeah, I know. You wouldn't have took it if you would have told me.
Sounds like they tried to set you up. Because, man, what if that would have turned into the dude shooting or something, man? I mean, like, this is a criminal act, you know? This is a criminal, you know? I mean, it sounded like they said, man, who can we get to do it? Let's send the black guy. You know, he's expendable.
That's exactly what I was thinking, man. But like I said, I actually quit, but I just didn't feel comfortable at the place that I went to, so I just came back like super quick. But, man, I'm still planning on quitting soon, but, like, dude.
Gus, I have an observation, if no one's going.
Yes, sir. Proceed. Well, there was, I think we had our caller in Michigan. She hadn't shared it all yet.
Oh, no problem. Okay, no problem. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers and listeners. I just wanted to add to the workplace racism. I did get another position at a different law firm, and I found it was interesting. I also agree with you had read a portion from someone who wrote in about locking your computers and making sure you're not just leaving or reading or leaving information, you know, just about your personal life out because they, you know, white people are nosy. And so I'm in a new law firm and I just found it interesting. I work with, it's about four or five white women in my particular area. One is a white woman who's married to a so-called Arab. There's another white lady. She is, you know, she brags about being in the army and how, you know, the time she spent in the army. And then there's another white lady who's classified as like a Chaldean or something, or I don't know. She's like either Greek or Chaldean, but she's a lesbian. And I'm the only black person. And so it was interesting because they hired another person, another female, and she's white. She's kind of what people would call a dizzy blonde or whatever. But she's, you know, pretty well off, and she's really new. She just started in the firm as like a secretary, and she doesn't know much, but they're being really patient with her. But the one white lady that was from the military, she doesn't like her. I guess they kind of clashed on the first or second day. So these two white women, I've just been observing how, you know, they're clashing. And so the one from the military made a statement, was like, yeah, we know how to get rid of people around here that we don't like. And, you know, she was like, we just make you feel really uncomfortable. And we will, you know, if we don't like you, you'll just get really uncomfortable and we'll make sure you're out of here. And so we think we're going to have to do that to her because, you know, her and the lady, they clashed. And so it was just interesting to see, like, I'm like, wow, okay, I don't know if that was a message to me or that, you know, it was just interesting that she said that. So her plan is to band with the other white ladies and make this new girl get really uncomfortable so she can leave. It was just interesting. And then, you know, it's just a different environment. So I'm looking forward to just, you know, reporting, I guess, my experience, one thing that I noticed already, you know, they always make a statement to me, yo, you're so quiet. You're just so quiet because I go in. I'm not, you know, talkative. I'm very polite, you know, good morning, but I'm not talkative at all. I just go in and do, you know, things that I'm contracted to do and I leave. But the quietness makes them uncomfortable. So I just thought that was interesting. But I just, again, look forward to just talking about this experience because it is a different environment. And I'm observing that while working with white women is, oh, it's just treacherous. So that's all I wanted to share.
Seems like two work environments in a row where you've had conniving white wenches looking to get rid of another white woman on the job, unless I'm mistaken.
Yep, exactly. Another scenario. So,
Fascinating. That might even be a good time to be very observant and really mindful about what's happening with you, because I think they were trying to rope you into getting rid of the last white woman on the job. So that might be a part of this plan as well.
Yeah, and it's really interesting how I coincidentally sit next to the lady who they're trying to get rid of. It's, you know, it's just interesting. And the lady that they're trying to get rid of, the one who's really ditzy, so to speak, she, you know, I noticed she wants to ask me all the questions to help her navigate through her first days where she doesn't get along with the other white ladies. And I'm like, well, I'm new too, so I don't know nothing. I'll just play the dumb black lady because I'm not trying to get, you know, I don't want to get wrapped up in y'all mess. So I'm playing the role like, nope, I don't understand either. I'm still learning, so I have no value to help you. So it's just interesting.
I wanted to say, I don't think it was a coincidence that they put you next to that white woman. I think they tried to subconsciously niggerize her by putting you in that same area. I notice white people tend to do that. Sometimes they'll kind of put people that they don't like in a certain area, and it's almost like the dunce corner minus the dunce cap. So it might have been strategic in a subconscious way of niggerizing that white female, and maybe even a subconscious way of kind of telling you if you don't get in line, you'll be in a similar position to her as far as you saying that you feel that your potential quietness is discomforting to them. So just be mindful, I think, like Gus was saying, but I definitely don't think it was a coincidence that they put you next to her like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't try to help her or nothing because you see they got it out for her. They see you helping her or something, they're going to switch you on you. Look at her. We already told her what was up. So yeah. They want to see, they're testing you to see if you're going to play the game or not. And, you know, I mean, if it was a black female, I'd say, you know, but this is a white female, you know, I'll just cut your losses, you know. I don't know nothing, just like you're doing, and stay as far away from her as possible.
Riot. I know some of the listeners would say they're not even helping the black person on the job, so the white person is definitely not going to be getting help. The caller at 7891, did you have commentary you were going to add to workplace racism?
Hi, good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening, Gus, and to everyone else on the line. I just had a couple quick experiences. This is the first time I've actually been able to chime in to the show, so I'm definitely grateful for the quietness I'm around today. A couple quick things. Today, I actually wanted to leave an item for a coworker. Shout out to Roz. And I wanted to leave it for him because, you know, he wasn't working today. And I won't see him until I get back from vacation. Then I thought about it, well, I don't want to leave it on his desk because there's too many eyeballs around. So I asked another coworker who's familiar with the two of us, you know, can you make sure that he gets this on Monday? The main reason I did not want to leave it on his desk is because it's in the RBG colors. And, you know, bad enough, you know, when we, you know, have conversation, their ears are perked. And they're trying to hear what we're talking about. So I want to be very careful on what I leave at my desk, which is nothing. And I definitely picked up on the suggestions from previous shows, you know, about the material that you bring to work. I bring very neutral books with me when I'm at work, and I don't bring up any websites or anything like that while I'm at work. The second situation that I wanted to bring up was actually involving my son. He started an overnight job part-time because he does freelance work. So initially he was working for a department store, and he was working in the back overnight. And then he started putting him with certain other individuals more towards the front of the store, and they were pretty much terrorizing him. My son is very quiet. He's a very intelligent, very straight, this how it is type of person, and he doesn't bother anyone, but don't bother him. So he calls me one day. He goes, you know, Mom, you know, these people are about to see who I am, and I know what that means. So I told him, I asked him, I was like, you know, what's going on? So he said there's this one particular white employee that would constantly, like, say things under his breath and try to, like, provoke him to either say or do something. So what I told him to do, well, first I asked him, is he doing this around other people? And he wasn't. So then I asked him, so where are you when he's trying to provoke you? And it was always in a secluded area. So I told him, I said, you know what? The next time you walk and you make sure you look around and make sure that there's some type of camera, some type of video. I said, and if you have to, pull out your phone. I said, because what he's trying to do is to provoke you to do something and then say that you started it, because he's, you know, no one's going to believe that he did it or that he started it. So just, you know, make sure you're in, you know, either somewhere around someone else, make sure there's cameras around, or if push comes to shove, you pull out your own phone and you record them. And since he did that, he said he hasn't bothered him since. I said, but still watch back. I said, because you've so to speak, outsmarted him and let him know that, no, you're not going to provoke me, now he's going to scheme and try to get something else. So that just goes to show you, I mean, even, you know, we hear of, you know, women being terrorized at work and, you know, things happening on to women at work, and even to our black men at work as far as, you know, being called nigger or something to the fact, this isn't, you know, to that degree as far as him coming out and calling him nigger, but I won't put it past him. I would not put it past him. And my son is the kind, you know, if you push him too far, you know, you might see something, and I wouldn't want that to happen. So I had to kind of advise him, you know, through my experience and, you know, advising employees, because my background is in HR, and advising employees, you know, this is how you handle it, and these are the steps that you need to take. And just, you know, making sure that you document everything and making sure that, you know, someone else knows about it. You know, even if it's, you know, recorded on your phone or recorded some other way, have some type of documentation. So I just wanted to share those two pieces of information. Thank you for letting me share.
For sure.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm. Karma?
Can anybody respond to the question? And I think it was a guest we had, and this reminded me, her son's situation reminded me. Why do they always hire black women for HR? Why is there's a pattern there. There really is.
I can definitely answer that question. And it's because we're not afraid to speak up. We're not afraid to handle the tough situations, and we're made bad guy. So when they need to, you know, trickle down some information that may not be hard to take for the employees, they're going to put, you know, the black woman out there. They're going to put, you know, the minority woman out there, so it's easier to swallow for the employees. If it's coming straight from management or straight from, you know, the white executive, you know, they're scared of the uproar. They're scared of the backlash. So if you put a black woman out there speaking to especially black or minority employees, they're more apt to either accept it or the backlash will not be as tough. So there's definitely a pattern. Definitely a pattern, and that's one of the reasons why I left HR, is because, you know, you're putting me out there to do all this, you're putting me out there to do this dirty work, and you're treating me like management, but you don't want to promote me, you don't want to pay me as management, and you don't want to recognize me as management. So you're no longer going to use me, you know, as your puppy to do your dirty work. So there, yes, to answer your questions, there's definitely a pattern, definitely. Thank you.
Do we have a male caller that's in HR? I thought he had been sharing about he was the person that people were going to when they were having problems or reporting some form of mistreatment or incorrect behavior on the job, and he was the person that was kind of in a situation to mediate. I'm not sure if he's on the line now, but just maybe if he...
The caller who asked to do the prayer.
Right. I thought he might have... It sounded like he was in a position that might have been HR-related. Maybe if he hears the archive, he can chime in the future on Karma's question. I did want to make sure I got him my commendation. That is outstanding. I think I've heard so many black people say that they didn't have anybody to give them suggestions or tips on how to deal with racism on the job, and to be able to have a black mom a week after Mother's Day, a black mom being able to give her child some constructive information to help him neutralize some of the racist shenanigans on the job. That is outstanding. Just great to hear. Anybody have any follow-up questions they want to ask what they heard? Or I said, I will also make sure I second you do not certainly. I have suggested for years not having anything on your desk at your work area that is not related to the job that you're doing, like nothing, photographs, candy dish, nothing at your area, just to minimize. It doesn't just minimize the nosy factor, but it also, you do not want to have any reason, any excuse for white people spending any extra time at your desk. If it's a candy dish, if it's a photograph, not only is that extra information, now that's more time. Now I have an excuse to come and hang out at your desk or what have you, to act like I'm coming to get a piece of candy, or I just want to look at your updated photographs. When are you going to put up new photographs? Just another reason for you to come by and do more snooping, more interrogation, asking more questions, trying to get more information. I am a huge fan of being a minimalist. And if things do take a turn for the worse, which happens frequently under this system, and you are terminated, I think even callers have said that they enjoy you having to pack up all of your trinkets and walk out when you don't have all that stuff there. I don't even need a box. I'm empty-handed. I don't have anything here, but the things that I needed to do my job. Maybe I have a pen that I will take with me that's mine, but very much a proponent of no unnecessary stuff on the desk and not leaving gifts and that sort of thing, because I've seen where white people are. I mean, they steal everything. They steal people, so why wouldn't they steal a gift that was left for someone else? So definitely a good suggestion on that one as well, not leaving things for other employees. Make sure you can put it in their hand. Roz, were you going to comment as well, sir?
Yes, I was. I wanted to say big up to Sister V, and definitely she has helped a few people on the job with HR questions, dealing with issues. So if there's callers that might have situations, she's brilliant, and she's really great. And just to get to my workplace observation, we had a training this week, and it was supposed to be based on cooperation. So there were three different groups that were brought in there of three people, and they all have their own teams. I'm on one of the teams, and they had us all mismatched. So all the teams were together into three separate teams of one of each member of each group. And they gave us this scenario. So they said that we were surgeons at a hospital, and our committee must make a very important decision. Seven patients need a heart transplant. There's only one heart donor at this time. All of the patients are eligible to receive the heart, all are physically able, and all have compatible tissue and blood typing. Which patient would you choose to receive the heart? And that the committee must agree on the choice. So the first was a 31-year-old male African-American brain surgeon at the height of his career with no children. The next was a 12-year-old female Vietnamese accomplished violinist who was blind. The next was a 40-year-old male Hispanic teacher with two children. The next was a 15-year-old female white, unmarried, and 6 months pregnant. The next was a 35-year-old male Hispanic Roman Catholic priest. The next was a 17-year-old female white waitress, high school dropout, supports and cares for her brother who is severely disabled. And the last one was a 38-year-old female white AIDS researcher with no children who was a lesbian. So needless to say, I kept gearing towards the 31-year-old African-American male. And my logic was that he's a brain surgeon and that because he's at the height of his career, he can save more people's lives. With his life being saved, he'll be able to save other people's lives. That was my premise. So we go through the whole process, and we finally settle in. He almost got chosen, but we ended up settling in on the 40-year-old male Hispanic teacher with two children, and that was because he can also affect lives of children as an educator. So bottom line was I wasn't letting any white people live in this scenario. And what I found out, because we have nurses, clinical nurses that are part of the team, so I were asking them questions about how this process would go. And they said, even though they would take a lot of other factors into consideration, like whether the person smoked or not, or how they would treat the organ that they would receive by their lifestyle, one thing they did say was that they do take into account the person's ability to contribute to society, and they vaguely alluded to race being a factor as well. And I just sat there and I thought to myself, wow, how many black people probably were overlooked for a transplant simply because they were black, and not because, you know, they might have had the same qualifications as the brain surgeon, but because they were black, they were basically life unworthy of life. And again, I just get these subtle clues towards the way race works in the healthcare system, and it's just some of it is so subtle, and then other times it's just overt and just in your face, like what we're seeing in the book. So it's just, we have to be very conscientious about every aspect of the healthcare field that we interact with and try our best to not have to interact with them by living the healthiest lifestyle possible, being highly cognizant of our mental health. And thank you for listening to my workplace racism observations.
Wow. Can I make a comment on that, Gus, real quick?
Yes, sir.
Man, it's funny because, not funny, but it's ironic because they probably wouldn't even know how to do a heart surgery if they didn't operate on some slave and try to figure it out on probably a few hundred slaves until they got it perfected. I just wanted to piggyback off of the caller from Michigan that went to the law firm because I've seen this happen too. So I would just say for that white lady that is working there, and they don't like her, and they're going to gang up on her. You know, although you want to stay away from her, but also be nice to her, because white people have special powers. One day she could come in with, like, some ginger snap cookies or hook everybody up with some coupons or something, and she becomes everyone's best friend. And it's like, oh, that black one over there, she was mean to me, you know, and they turn on you. So be very cautious of that, because I've seen that play out a lot of times as well.
Good point. Well, we did our 3 hours, and we will be back in exactly 12 hours with the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. If folks have other commentary, confusion, suggestions, something wasn't clear, feel free. You can drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. I did want to say the two things that I shared with the worker in the Bay Area, the BART transit worker. I told him that I would ask for a written policy from both his employer, BART, as well as the enforcement office, the enforcement agency that does the security at the BART station. I would ask for their written policy on how they are, what is the written protocol in terms of how they're supposed to respond if a BART employee is threatened with violence. Because I know they have got to have a written policy about exactly what is supposed to be done, who's supposed to do it, documentation, the whole nine, particularly if there's been a spike in this sort of activity. I am certain, because they were having protests at the BART station back with Oscar Grant and all that, I'm sure they have written protocol. I would ask for it in writing from both agencies and then ask if that procedure was followed with what happened in his situation or situation, since he said it happened multiple times. And Dr. Kamal Kamban, I've talked to him, and he's in these type of instances, he has recommended go see a doctor and go see a mental health professional, because you want to generate documentation in the same way that they do. Because this person, this victim, was saying that they felt this was impacting their health, and it certainly is, making them being stressed. I would go and report, I'm having trouble sleeping, headaches, I feel anxious, almost as though I'm having a panic attack. It has affected my energy. It's affected me wanting to be around other people. I would write out as many symptoms as you can. That way, even if you don't choose to do anything in the future, just to have that documented, if you can go see a health physician and a doctor, they might even say, hey, this person needs to get, a week of paid time off work, that they're having all of these traumatic events happening on work, and it's impacting their health. They need, a week, 2 weeks off of vacation time to calm their heart rate. It's really stressful for them, and I'm concerned about their well-being. Just get that documented. In fact, Daryl Muhammad, he was mentioned, that was the black male in the Bay Area who was also being terrorized on the job. He went to see a healthcare practitioner, and that was what they said. In fact, I think he had to go and see multiple healthcare practitioners. One, he had a workplace injury, and then the stress of dealing with all of the racism that was happening to him on the job. But those are two things I know Dr. Kamban would recommend. That way it's documented. You can show that you were experiencing these things, certainly document the earlier incidents of white supremacy that were happening on the job and exactly what was said, even for the incident the female caller was saying with her son. Documenting exactly what this person is saying every time, if they're coming in to taunt you, if it's name calling, whatever it is, keep a record of that. That's something that gets encouraged almost on a weekly basis, and I think is extremely important. Document it, write it down with as much detail as possible. Your memory, none of us, our memory is not as good as we think, particularly 6 months, a year down the line. You just won't remember all of the exact details, the date, the time, exactly verbatim what was said. All of that can be extremely important, more so than you might realize at that moment. With that, again, we'll be here tomorrow. This week, we should be here tomorrow, Tuesday. We're going back to New Orleans. They just had a great article in the paper talking about the pseudo effort to return the public schools in New Orleans. They have the charter school system there, but to return the school control of the schools to local citizens. It's predominantly a black city, to return control of the schools to the black residents of New Orleans. And Anitra Brown, she is with the New Orleans Tribune. She was on before talking about the Hurricane Katrina, the 10-year anniversary. She's been talking about this, and the folks at the New Orleans Tribune have been talking about this as a total racist farce. They are not trying to return control to black citizens at all. They're just giving the appearance that that's what they're doing. This got reported in the New York Times as well. It was on the front page earlier this week. She should be back on the program on Tuesday. Pam should be here on Wednesday. Everybody's favorite topic, how to deal with having a family member who has married a white person, strategies, tips on navigating that whole situation. She should be here Wednesday. I spoke with Dr. Welsing's sister, Lauren Kresslove, today. We're going to see what her schedule looks like. She might be visiting with us on Thursday to give an update, just to share more information. It was great to speak with her today. And I will say it was unpleasant to hear, but I was extremely happy when I did hear it. Not only did Dr. Frances Kress Welsing die, but her other sister, Barbara Kress Lawrence, she passed away just a few weeks after Dr. Welsing passed away this year. So it's been a very traumatic year, to say the least, for Lauren Kress Love. But she said she would have to check her calendar because she is getting therapy to deal with the grief from her losses. I was extremely happy to hear that she is actively managing her health as best she can. That was something I, talked with her before and just said I hope that she was doing as best she can to take care of herself. So I was very glad to hear that, although, I mean, that is extremely sad is not even the word. But it was good to hear that she is doing that, and I hope that's something that we can take from that as well, to do as much as you can to get help in managing our health. We are under constant assault Racists do everything that they can to have us in a state of dis-ease, depression, sadness. You can think of Kalief Browder again. They do everything that they can to put us in that position. Even the black mom who was telling us about her son being constantly terrorized on the job to get him to a point where he can act out, and then they'll have an excuse to terminate him. Just recognize when you are stressed, recognize when you're frustrated, depressed, and try to get help as best you can, even if it's you don't want to go to a therapist or what have you, even if you have people that you trust who will listen to you. Sometimes it can just be helpful if you can talk, if you can get some of the frustration or pain, if you can verbalize that, having one or two people that you can talk to. It is extremely important. Black mental health, stressed that at the beginning of the year, that's something that we should be extremely mindful of under conditions of white terrorism. Hopefully we'll be able to speak to Lauren Cress Love this week, but more important, her taking care of her black health. With that, again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. That's what they will encourage. Oh, you're feeling bad? You should get a 40 ounce of this, or have some legalized marijuana or whatever else, crystal meth, anything else that they come down the pike with. Sobriety, you do not want to make it easier for race soldiers to terrorize you, your family, cause you unnecessary problems and strife for decades. Certainly, if you're going to be behind the wheel, driver, passenger, even as a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence. You're just making the job of Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, 1,000 times easier. We want to be able to make the best possible decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible, you and anybody that you might be responsible for. Also, certainly buckle up every time if you're in an automobile. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice. Immediately. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.